start now. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, and everyone, let me welcome you to one of our energy stakeholders meetings. Thank you very much for coming out, honorable members and everyone here. I see there's quite a diverse number of stakeholders. That is very encouraging, which means we're on track, we're doing the right thing. Maybe before we even go much into why are we here, just to emphasize, this is our sixth stakeholders meeting, whereby we invite various stakeholders, of course opening up to the public as well. It's a variant to public hearings, and I'm sure some of you are aware of public hearings, whereby we, those who are keen to make their oral submissions in a public hearing are given 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Then as members, we just throw a couple of questions, and then thereafter, thank you very much, they leave, and we're left to deliberate on the submissions. And in this instance, what we do, the first hour, we have a few aspects, as you can see, even in the agenda, who then make presentations, and I hope everyone, you have your pens and papers ready, and then the rest of the time until we close, we allow everyone to make inputs. But given that it seems we have chosen a topic that's so popular, please bear with me. I may have to be quite strict with the amount of time I give during a general discussion. It will not for any other reason other than to allow as many people to make inputs. This practice is new with the committee, is new in Parliament. But obviously we hope it will have an impact on Parliament at the end of the day. It enhances other forms of public involvement. The public hearings, as I say, very similar but a variant, because it allows, it's more flexible, it allows more inputs immediately, or responses to inputs by those who will make presentations. Once again, on that respect, thank you very much for coming out in a rainy Cape Town afternoon, even those who flew all the way from other cities. Today, we're looking at nuclear energy as an option for sustainable supply of energy. I take it that the stakeholders were interested or even engaged and involved in this sector. We have one thing in common. We would like to see and ensure our country having not just adequate but sustainable supply of energy. I don't need to tell you what we're facing right now. Just recently we had an input once again from the Department of Energy to the Portfolio Committee on Energy around energy efficiency, and we're very, very upfront about that we're not necessarily that convinced the department could have been doing more, because energy efficiency is just one of the low-hanging fruits to ensure supply of energy, or at least a little bit better than ensuring, you know, increased supply of energy. Nuclear energy is one of the components of the integrated resource plans 2010. 9.6 gigawatts is planned by government, which is about 23%. Up to now, there hasn't been much debate in this manner, insofar as I know. I know the nuclear NEASA, the Association on Nuclear Energy or Nuclear Industry, has arranged a couple of these events, which was good because it allows debate to take place. And honestly and frankly, for those who are pro and those who are not pro nuclear energy, we're not going to run away from that. We're not going to hide it. But equally, we're not going to hide the fact that the government has taken a very clear position that it's going to steadfastly move ahead and along on the nuclear energy sphere. And as part of the one of the components of the states, as parliament, we also have to play our role to facilitate public participation. We almost had an amendment on the Nuclear Act coming this year, but unfortunately, I'm sure it's going to miss this term. It probably will come in after elections, but still coming, and amongst other things, that's in preparation for the new nuclear build program. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not for me to give a sermon today. There are better people who and better equipped to do that. All I wanted is to articulate as to why we are here. Just this morning I was invited by SAOGA, that's SA Oil and Gas Alliance, where they were engaging on oil and gas issues. And down the line we're going to be having an 8th convention on on energy efficiency in November. I missed the wind convention recently. I think it was last week. Still coming. Okay, I see a head shaking. Apologies. The story goes on. So, other energy, there are platforms to address and debate other energy careers and sources. So it's equally logical that we give space and platform to address this one. Very complex, intricate, sensitive, controversial, and all the likes. But it's there. It's part of our lives. I'm not going to say what the expert will say. It's for them to present their cases. We have 4 topics here, and I'm eating into their time, unfortunately, so that I give space to them. The first one is that the department will open for us to give us the government's view on what we regard as the Balancing Act. Why have nuclear energy in the integrated resource plan? I see Mr. Odette is around, and I hope he's close, he better come pretty close, because I won't give him a second to start. He should just be next to the laptop. From there, Professor Lloyd is going to give us a very frank overview, and as well know him, a very frank overview on the state of readiness on new nuclear build program in terms of each stakeholder. And from next, I've got Dr. Nofnahoel, who will share with us what their views are on nuclear energy technology. Is it advancing for the better? Is it just at a level of stagnation or retrogressing. And Ms. Judy Nogredi from NIASA will give us a global overview, a very continental perspective on prospects of nuclear energy, because we're not operating on our own, we're part of the global village. Hopefully, with that, it will give us quite a balanced view for us to be able to debate. Once again, thanks very much for coming. You're very much welcome. Now it's time for me to keep quiet and just facilitate the debate and discussion. Over to you, Dr. Odet.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members present here today, members of the public, all protocol observed. Chair, I included two additional slides, so now I'm trying to...
Can you get closer to your microphone, please? We've got quite a big crowd. Yeah, they have their pens and pens ready, so you better be audible.
Chair, I was saying I added two additional slides, so I'm trying to upload the updated version of the presentation. So, Ariko, if you could assist. Once again, thanks, Chairperson, honorable members present. My name is Thabang Odet from the Department of Energy. So I'll be presenting today a basis upon which the nuclear power generation was ultimately included in the current version of the Integrated Resource Plan. So what I've decided to do is to, you know, go back to where it all started, because we think it's important that we cover the basis and the background upon which the IRP, the so-called IRP 2010, was developed. And therein we will focus specifically on those key elements in terms of the modeling of the Integrated Resource Plan, those specific nuclear assumptions that were made right at the beginning. So from the Nuclear Energy Act, from the Nuclear Policy to the Nuclear Energy Act to the Integrated Resource Plan, I won't go into the detailed procurement program that is currently being initiated around nuclear. So where I will end is a rationale of why is nuclear part of the South Africa's energy mix as it stands today. So I'll cover some context in terms of our generation mix. I will explain the rationale why we want or why we have a national long-term electricity generation plan. I will also touch on the process that was followed to develop the integrated resource plan. For the purpose of, you know, to enhance today's discussions, I will focus specifically on the nuclear input assumptions that were made about 3 years ago when we're developing the IRP. Obviously, those that are familiar with the format of the Integrated Resource Plan will be aware that there's about 9,600 megawatts as part of our energy mix included in the integrated resource plan. My purpose is not to defend the integrated resource plan, but it's merely to explain the process that we went through and to present the final policy document as it stands. And the whole objective is to enhance the discussions around nuclear. And obviously we will conclude. Chair, the current IRP or the Integrated Resource Plan is a 20-year national electricity generation plan. And this must be seen in the context of an integrated energy plan, which is currently being developed by the department. Next week, there will be the initial stages of the public consultation phase in relation to the integrated energy plan. So, quickly to explain the rationale, we have right at the top an integrated energy plan. Below that energy plan, there are three plans. One of them is the electricity generation plan, which we refer to as integrated resource plan. So the focus of the presentation is on this specific electricity generation plan. As I indicated, it's a 20-year national electricity generation plan. It's not a short-term or medium, it's not an operational plan. It's merely a long-term plan that seeks to direct the expansion of the current fleet of electricity power stations. Right? And I will explain how we got to the current version of the IRP 2010, which includes 9,600 megawatts of nuclear electricity generation as one of the technology options. This long-term electricity plan seeks to give South Africa a long-term perspective, and it takes into consideration the technical constraints in terms of the capacity of the country, the maximum amount of electricity that can be injected into the grid, in other words, the technical constraints. It also takes into account the cost element and the affordability of these different options, in other words, the economic constraints. There is a social element in the IRP in terms of which technologies will generate a sufficient number of employment right from the bottom low-skilled type of employment up to the highly skilled engineering / scientific type of employment. There are also certain externalities that we took into consideration. Externalities such as your carbon emissions, South Africa's intentions in terms of the maximum amount of emissions that we want to constrain the country to. So all of those are taken into account in developing this 20-year electricity plan. The purpose of the IRP can be categorized into the theoretical purpose and the practical purpose of the integrated resource plan. In theory, we want to identify the required investments in the electricity sector. So in 20 years time, we are saying this is the number of projects that we need to invest in to make sure that the projected increase in electricity demand is met on time. Practically, there are various issues that the projected increase in electricity, in other words, the forecast is a dynamic trajectory. In other words, 3 years ago, the projection was X percent, but as you go into the 20 year of the IRP, that forecast is revised and could change. In reality, it actually changed. In practice, it changes. As well, in practice, there are cost elements that the country can afford this type of a plan. So, in theory, we have a certain number of investments in order for us to meet the projected economic growth linked to that, obviously, the electricity growth. In practice, we need to take into account that that projected growth will change, that there are huge costs associated with an incorrect plan, incorrect investments. So to summarize again, there's a theoretical part to the IRP, there's a practical part as well. Although we are saying this is a long-term plan, in reality, there is no plan that is fixed for a period such as a 20-year period. We do acknowledge that periodically we will need to relook into our initial assumptions. And at the right point in time, initially we had anticipated a 2-year period that we would review this plan. But the experience has taught us otherwise. This plan is not fixed for 20 years. It is revised periodically. Initially, we had said 2 years, but we are now revising it this year, and we have started the initial stages of revising at least the input assumptions into the IRP. The growth in electricity demand is directly linked to the economic growth. There is a relationship factor, a multiplication factor between the projected economic growth and the anticipated growth in electricity demand. There is a social welfare component that also, given the history of our country, the social element also influences the increase in demand of electricity, because we're trying to correct all of those injustices of the past. In short, we have certain services that influences our growth in electricity demand. We have what we refer to as key customers within the Eskom suite of customers. These are your large industrial customers, such as the mines, huge factories. We have the services sector, we have the airports, we have the communication sector. So these influences, if these sectors grow at such a steep demand, they will influence the rate at which electricity growth is projected. There are other social elements to it: education, increase in health, the safety, and increase in food production. So these also influences the rate at which the electricity demand grows. The other problematic areas that we took into account in developing the IRP is that electricity is not like your other ordinary commodities. You cannot store it and use it when you need it. Electricity, the engineering of electricity generation is that you must meet the demand instantaneously as and when it is required. So you cannot store electricity for, you know, a couple of days and release it when it's required. As soon as your demand grows, instantaneously you must meet that demand with sufficient supply. The other challenge is that it takes a couple of years to from the point where you make a decision that you're going to build a certain power station to a point where that power station is injecting electricity into the national grid. So it's not, you know, it doesn't take a couple of months from construction to a point where that station generates electricity. It takes a couple of years. So in other words, you need to plan ahead. You need to know what your demand will look like in the next 7, 8, 10 years. Obviously, it's in the future, so you make certain assumptions and you take your decisions to start building based on those assumptions. Electricity is also linked to other infrastructure development, as I indicated, your large customers such as your mines and your other services. So anticipation, we need to anticipate the needs in the future. Right? We need to, as accurate as possible, we need to second guess what the future will look like in order for us to make the right decisions today around which power stations to construct. The reason why we need to do that is that your supply, that it must be ready at the right time. The volumes or the amount of energy that it generates must be sufficient enough to cover the demand at that time. The quality of the power station that you make a decision on, it must be as close as possible to what the reality will look like you know, when it's required. And obviously it must be affordable to the country. So these are the key questions that the IRP needed to answer for the next 20 years. Quickly, without spending too much time on the graph, the blue or purple line, so in other words, there's almost a straight line that goes right through to 66 gigawatts to the top of the chart. That's the anticipated demand. So we project the demand into the future. The current projection is up to, the IRP is up to 2030. So at that point, we drew a line from that point, and we need now to put in place plans to be able to meet that projected increase in demand. The reddish line, in other words, this line there, that's the available capacity to meet the demand. So in other words, if we leave things as is with the current Kusile, Ingula, and Medupi, and we don't do anything else, this is how the picture would look like. So if we go beyond, in 2008 or so, you can see that we were in a situation where the capacity was more than the demand, the projected demand. There were issues in 2008 in terms of rotating load shedding, but those were not capacity-specific issues. We are currently in 2013, where we can see that the available dispatchable capacity is less than the projected demand. That point there is where we expect Medupi and Kusile to come on stream. Then suddenly your capacity becomes more than your projected demand. But if we do nothing else at that point, then there's a switch over again. there's a switch over again where your reddish line starts to deteriorate and your demand continues to increase. So there is a gap between what the consumers are demanding and what is available to dispatch. So the IRP, the green line, seeks to balance off that gap between this line and the other line. We are currently maintaining the system under the so-called Emergency Response and Business Continuity Plan, which is currently managed by the state utility. The implementation of IRP 2010, the Green Line, including renewable gas and nuclear power, will ensure that we meet that gap there between the projected demand and the available dispatchable capacity. The reason why this reddish line deteriorates is that some of our current coal power stations are reaching a maturity point where they need to be, you know, they become unsafe and unreliable to operate, so they need to be decommissioned. But as we decommission them, the IRP then indicates that we need to make certain decisions at this point so that at that time there, those power stations are ready and available to meet the demand-supply gap. The IRP also needs to answer the, you know, although it's an electricity plan, there are other elements intrinsically linked to a power station. There's a water issue that you need to have sufficient supply of bulk water. That there is a primary energy resource issue. For example, if you're looking at a gas fired power station, you need to have sufficient gas to do that. If you're looking at coal, you need to have enough coal to be able to supply into that station. We also need to develop skills within the borders of the country. It's those new technologies that we have taken a decision that we will also initiate a similar type of power plant. We need to ensure that the localization element thereof, you know, it enhances our local skills. In other words, we don't bring international companies to construct and to manage these power stations and they live with the skills. We need to make sure that as part of the contracts, there is a skills transfer element that they would sign with either the government or an entity nominated by government to manage these programs. So the skills transfer is a critical issue. There's also a transmission issue and the availability of land. The issue of cost, and funding of these power stations is intrinsically linked to the decisions that we make. So we need to be, in terms of, obviously we'll never be 100% sure in terms of how much the cost will be, but we need to make certain assumptions at the point where we say now we are ready to initiate the following program. The real cost, you will only be aware of what the real cost is when we go to the market. The costs that we make or the cost assumptions that we make today are merely theoretical. You will only know the actual real cost once you test the market. We did the same thing with the renewable energy program. We made certain assumptions around the cost. We have tested the market. Now we have a South African specific renewable energy cost that obviously will feed into the revised into the current process to revise the IRP. But my point is, you know, at a certain point you make certain theoretical assumptions around some of these elements, and as you implement, that's the only way to know the actual numbers instead of making theoretical assumption. I've touched on the issue of cost. The implementation of the IRP, we have, and I must admit that the team is learning as we implement more and more programs around the IRP. the next version of the integrated resource plan will touch on the transmission issue, will touch on the implementation issue. The first IRP was merely to say this is the first bite and we are going through that whole experience. We are now at a point where the revised IRP will be much more enhanced in terms of the information. What the IRP seeks to do, in short, you have a country needs in the middle, right? We have the way currently we have around that area there. We have most of our, around Mpumalanga area, we have most of our power stations, coal-fired power stations. Right? Now, as we expand, as we move away from a coal-dominated electricity supply, there are certain issues that we needed to take into account. Issues such as the cost of this plan, will it meet the security of supply for the country and to some extent for the region, for the neighboring countries? The carbon emission, should the international community decide on certain penalties relating to carbon emission? We don't want South Africa to be suddenly to have to make a switch which naturally will take long. So we are planning in anticipation that we need to keep a careful eye on the carbon emission of this plan. The water availability, there is a competing need for water in South Africa. So we don't want to impose additional demand on the water, available supply of water. The process that we went through, in short, I won't go into too much detail. There are three phases, right? There's an input phase of the integrated resource plan. Right? There's a modeling phase. In other words, we take those input assumptions that we make and the policies and the facts into a modeling instrument, a modeling tool. Obviously, we define the methodology that this modeling tool should follow. And then comes out the outputs or the outcomes. These outcomes, we categorize them in the IRP1. We categorize them in terms of price, security of supply, carbon emissions, how diversified is that output, and obviously the economic benefits for the country. In terms of the input, and now I'm getting into the rationale why the final integrated resource plan looks the way it does. At the beginning, there was no preference or exclusion of one technology over another. At the beginning, it was a scientific approach. We take certain assumptions, we take the existing policies at that point, and all of the entire data set is put into that modeling tool or instrument. So in terms of our inputs, the general inputs, specific demand inputs, and obviously the supply side of the inputs. In the supply, you get the, for each technology, you make certain assumptions around how much this technology would cost. And the cost is not only, you know, it's not only the overnight capital cost, as it's referred to, but it's the entire life cycle cost of these technologies. There is a load factor associated with each technology. And that's why you get some technologies being referred to as base load. Some technologies being referred to as base load, others being referred to as peaking or mid-merit. Because of how you can dispatch these technologies. Some technologies, you don't even have control over how they are dispatched. I mean, for example, a wind turbine will only generate electricity so long as there is wind blowing, unless if you have some sort of a storage behind it. There are externalities such as the cost of carbon emission. Currently, there is no real penalties. The current cost is the pollution to the environment, but there is no real penalties that globally is payable based on the amount of carbon that a country emits. but there are ongoing discussions, and this could become a seriously constraining externalities should the global environment decide to impose those cost penalties. I am told to hurry up, so I won't go into too much detail. Some of the slides I will skip and try and focus on the nuclear parts. The technologies that we looked at as coal, nuclear, right at the beginning. So these are the technologies that we assumed South Africa has resources to implement. Coal, obviously, there's a whole lot of coal mining taking place. Nuclear, we have experience in nuclear, such as Google. Gas, we have gas resources, although not fully explored, but there are indications. Renewable technologies, we have seen the renewable IPP program, we do have resources. Hydro and pump storage. Hydro, by and large, streaming hydro will be imported to some extent, and we have certain pumped storage that we can use to balance the peak demand. The cost of all of these plants, the investment cost, the refurbishment cost, and the decommissioning cost, as I indicated, we're not only looking at the overnight capital cost. There are other cost elements linked to each technology decision. These are more of the supply inputs that we took into account, the operation and maintenance. The water usage, although this might not be a direct cost, but there is a cost, a social cost to the environment. If you deploy a technology that, you know, uses most of the available water resource. Now, if Chair can dwell into the nuclear specific input. So I've covered the IRP process, I've explained the rationale, I explained the methodology, and on the input side of things, there are demand inputs, there are generic inputs, demand inputs, and supply inputs. Nuclear specific inputs will fall under the supply input category. The source that was used to inform the inputs that will ultimately flow into the IRP modeling tool is the what we refer to as the APRI report. Right? These costs is an overnight capital cost, which immediately you can see that there is a problem with it, because what about the other costs? What about the decommissioning cost, the waste management cost? You know, if you take those into account, that number, the 26,600 per kilowatt hour, suddenly becomes a different figure altogether. So in order to accommodate that, we increased that 26,575 by 40%. Precisely to accommodate other costs that are beyond the overnight capital cost estimate. And this is based on a 6-unit option, which is what the country is planning to. So the cost assumptions relating specifically to nuclear, I mean, those that are familiar with these engineering reports, you know, APRI is a reputable institution. So these numbers are not put together by some appointed consultant by the department. These numbers are international numbers. This is an international report. It's available on a website. For those that are interested, we can share it with. But my point is that we had an overnight capital cost of 26,575, and this was increased by 40% in order to accommodate those costs that are beyond the overnight capital cost. So the modeling tool, you know, without going into too much detail, the way it works, it says you want to achieve 100 power stations by 2030. In order for you to do that, what are your constraints? And we said constraints. We will say a constraint is we don't want to go beyond certain emissions. We don't want to go beyond a certain cost for the country. So all of these things gets inputted into this tool. And if any technology option is too expensive, it will not be part of the output. It will not be in the list of the options that will be thrown out by that model. So quickly, we had an input assumptions at that point. We developed certain scenarios, and then we narrowed down to a point where we got a few scenarios, five scenarios in total, which we refer to as balanced scenarios. Ultimately, we had the current integrated resource plan, which we refer to as a policy adjusted plan. The outcomes, key outcomes of this is the price path in terms of the average tariff at a wholesale level that the South African community would pay, the price per generation technology, so it will say this technology will cost you this much, this one will cost you this much. So outside the price cone, we had the carbon impacts and effects, the emissions. We set ourselves a constraint on the maximum amount of emission that we would allow the model to go beyond. So the model was not allowed to go beyond a certain emission. We made certain assumptions around how much the cost of carbon is costing currently and how much it's likely to cost should the international community reach a decision on that. Obviously, the critical issue is the security of supply. We want to have enough available supply to meet the projected demand. The last point there, the technologies that we choose, we're coming from a point where we have about 95% of our electricity being generated from one source, from coal. We want to move to a more diversified type of electricity generation. So the technology choice that we will implement is not one type over the other. It's more of a balanced technology mix. I won't go into that, but basically the current existing policies, these formed the inputs from a policy perspective. As I indicated right there at the top, there's a nuclear energy policy of 2008. IRP scenario, I won't go into too much detail. This is what the current plan looks like. So there is about 9,600 megawatts. This translates to 17% of our new fleet. So in other words, out of all these new technologies that the IRP proposes, nuclear accounts for 17%, and the renewable accounts for 42, if I recall correctly, and so it goes. So in terms of the available resource, because it's pointless for us to plan to have certain technology options being implemented in South Africa if we don't have the resource. Right there at the top, you have on your further left-hand side, you have solar, and right-hand side, you have wind. These two are the newly, not newly established, but in terms of converting those resources into electricity, the technologies are relatively new in South Africa. There is a solar map, or solar atlas, as it's referred, and the wind atlas. The solar atlas, there might be a slight delay in making it a public document, but I know that the wind atlas has been released. So this shows the resources that is available in the country. We have right there in the middle a gas option, and you can see the yellow block there, which is still another issue that is, you know, at an early stage, prior to even exploration phase. We have coal somewhere around the Transvaal in Mpumalanga area there, and We have a nuclear Quebec power plant in the Western Cape. So these are some of the resources that we have. Worldwide, in terms of nuclear, there's currently about four commercially operated nuclear power reactors, 440 of them. And these are in 30 countries. I'm not sure if you can see the screen there. The total percentage-wise in terms of the world's electricity is 14% of the world's electricity is generated from a nuclear-fired power plant. There are other countries that are involved in research of some sort, about 56 countries. Africa currently possesses about 15% of the available nuclear fuel, in other words, the uranium. Looking at the carbon emission for the entire life cycle, in terms of gigawatt hours, and comparing that to on one extreme coal, on the other extreme wind, you see that nuclear is seated third from the least emitting technology. And this would include issues such as manufacturing of those. For example, if you have a solar PV, the manufacturing process of everything that is used to ultimately build a solar PV plant, what are the carbon emissions? You can check the reference there at the bottom and read the report, the full report, which is available for public. In terms of where these energy reactors are located worldwide, you can see that in operation, so your green chart, in operation you have Europe, about 129 reactors in Europe, Western Europe. You have North America, which is second in terms of the ones that are in operation, 122 reactors. And look at the lower end of the chart. You have Africa there with only two reactors in the Western Cape. So this is the current, the 2010 World Energy Council report in terms of where these reactors are located. Africa is the lowest, followed by Latin America in terms of these nuclear reactors. Chair, in concluding, I apologize for taking too much time. To rehash, the IRP was based on the following, I hope, simple and straightforward approach. We made certain assumptions at the beginning, right at the beginning, before we even knew the outcome of this IRP, and those assumptions were in relation to the input numbers, the existing policies. Well, the existing policies were there, they were not assumptions, they were there. But the input numbers in terms of the demand assumptions, in terms of the supply technology, especially from a cost perspective. These assumptions were then inputted into a modeling tool, a modeling instrument. Then came the outcome, right? And I must emphasize that the assumptions, after having made those assumptions, the department went out on a public consultation process, which took about 4 weeks, if I recall correctly. These assumptions were tested against industry, were tested against general public. There were inputs. We still have database of the input that was received from the general public, from the specific industries. So at the end, we inputted this into a modeling tool. The modeling tool then gave certain outputs. These outputs were taken back for public consultation. So at that point, there was a public consultation after the inputs. Then we modeled the final inputs post public consultation. At that point, again, we went for a public consultation. That changed some of the outcomes of the public consultation, changed some of the outputs of the model, which we refer to that document as a policy adjustment. And then it was finally approved by Cabinet in 20, late 2010, but it was only promulgated early 2011, the integrated resource plan. As I indicated, the starting point was not to exclude any generation technology, but to rather assess the energy needs of the country and determine how best we can meet those. Specifically to nuclear, we have seen that the previous chart that, you know, if the localization aspect of our nuclear program is fully implemented and closely monitored, South Africa could position itself as Africa's nuclear electricity generator. So, Chair, I would like to conclude by projecting the current numbers as it stands in the IRP 2010. Perhaps before I finally conclude is that we have looked at the assumptions that we made in 2010. Starting next week, there will be, as part of the integrated energy plan consultation process, the revised IRP assumptions will be part of that process. So we will be tabling the revised IRP 2010 assumptions for public inputs together with the IEP public consultation phase. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. If you were not from God, then I would have long cut you. You've been rather over anxious to present your case. You still don't engage with this very, group of stakeholders. Once the very consultation process on IRP starts. Apologies for that to everyone. But obviously, let's hand over to Professor Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the invitation to speak this evening, and thank also the honourable members for finding the energy to be here, and the user too, sir. I think it's very credible, this whole process that you've got underway here. You invited me to speak on behalf of the various stakeholders, and I do so with an awful lot of modesty, because to try and represent all the views of everybody here is a bit of a challenge. But I've done my best, and I hope that you will forgive me if I don't cover everything. Fortunately, there is discussion.
Please don't represent them. Just articulate.
Just articulate.
So that you're not held to account thereafter.
What are the stakeholders? Well, first of all, I think there's the manufacturing industry. There is the construction industry, the government itself. Financial services are going to play a role in all of this. Power transmission and distribution. The media, the general public, and education and training. And finally, what I've called the environmental industry, and I trust that the environmental industry will forgive me for mentioning it in these terms, but the simple fact of the matter is that sustainable development is going to require economic, social, and environmental consideration, and we're not going to make any progress unless we can take all of them into account. So, turning now to manufacturing, looking at manufacturing, I think it's almost certainly capable of supporting an extended program in this country. An extended nuclear program. It's probably more or less ready to do so. However, I think that if there were only to be one or two reactors in South Africa, it probably wouldn't be sufficient to support the manufacturing industry from the mechanical side properly. To get everybody up to nuclear standards is going to take probably more than two. That means that in order to maximize the local content, we're going to have to look at more than one or two nuclear plants that we're going to go that in that direction. The alternative would be to import, and in fact, quite a lot of the first reactor will probably have to be imported. For three or more plants, of course, there would then be a very significant job creation, long-term job creation. As I said, I'm fairly convinced by the experience that the French have, where they certainly created over 100,000 long-term jobs by going for a really big nuclear fleet. But I think the important thing about the proposals from the department is that it does foresee a fleet, and this has very real benefits from the point of view of the manufacturing industry and the number of jobs that could be then created. If we look at now turn to construction, I think that construction is probably ready and probably capable of handling virtually anything this can be put there as long as it is properly scheduled. And, you know, this comes down to the sort of difficulty that we faced when we went into the World Cup, where there was very little scheduling of the construction. The system then really couldn't cope with trying to build all that civil construction at the rate we tried to do at that particular stage. So there would be a very clear message to government saying, please schedule these things properly, bear in mind the other infrastructure things that are happening in the country. But if there's proper head-end planning, I think that our industry will probably be able to cope with it. There are some very definite skill shortages, many of which have been shown up in the construction of things like the Dupi. And as long as we recognize them, we can get on with doing something about them and make things like the CETAs effective so they actually contribute rather than just drawing money. Then we might actually see some progress in getting the skills that we need. I think there's probably adequate capacity in the construction side of things to be able to do things, but and strictly speaking, the construction is not limited by the number of plants because they would almost certainly flow one after another. But the important thing is that by having a fleet of reactors, the civil performance would almost certainly improve as they went on. And this we have seen, the Chinese are now teaching the Americans how to build American reactors. And that's quite an interesting sort of view on things. On the government side of things, I think that it is basically well positioned. We do have presidential level oversight. Most of the governance structures are in place and reasonably effective. Things like the National Nuclear Regulator, I think, are doing quite a good job. The support structures are basically in place, and things like NEXA. But one of the things I would really urge is that there is some clear decision-making and there is a policy. Once the policy is there and is in place, to a large extent, we stick with it. Right now, it's quite clear that costs of the nuclear industry can escalate completely out of all regard if there is too much in the way of regulation of every single step along the way. So the timing of some of these things, particularly as regards the environmental things, is very critical that we actually resolve those time issues, because otherwise they do influence the costs. Energy planning itself seems to be reasonably sound, even if it takes a long time. Financial institutions, they're almost certainly have got adequate capacity to deal with many of the things here, but there is very limited experience, certainly in South Africa, in dealing with the nuclear industry. There's got to be quite a lot of learning curve there, and certainly from the financial side of things, I haven't heard very much real interest in this program at this stage. Whether it is they're waiting for government to declare the precise contractual arrangements, whether this is likely to be a public-private partnership, much like the REIPPP, or not, I don't know. But we're still waiting to see what on earth would happen with that in the financial area. And government, I think, needs to give some guidance as to the way in which it sees the private institutions being involved in the nuclear fleet should it come to pass. Certainly, however, the financial institutions are able to support procurement of capital goods, both internationally and locally, and to look after the construction of everything. But the big uncertainty is the role they will actually play in the overall program. And from that point of view, they've got to look to government. Transmission and distribution is one of the interesting things. There will almost certainly be considerable investment required, not least because the nuclear stations are going to be at the coast, and because they're at the coast, the transmission system is actually built the other way around at the present stage, whereby we actually feed from the Mpumalanga area and from Limpopo right the way down to the coast. That's going to be reversed with a large nuclear program, but there would have been some requirement to extend the size of our grid anyhow. There is a love affair with small grids. I don't think that it is really something that it falls into the nuclear debate to any particular point. But the big problem is that you can't have an awful lot of renewable energy in your system and have small grids and expect the lights to stay on, they go out. One of the big think that the media have a very keen interest in the nuclear side of things. They need a lot of information. They're fed an awful lot of misinformation, unfortunately. They seem to lack an understanding for the drivers of nuclear power. The drivers are fairly clear. We need base load. We need to try and, the other drivers to try and drive down the carbon dioxide emissions. As long as that is clearly understood, that's why we're going in these directions. I think that should come through more clearly. The trouble is that the news value of the disasters, or so-called disasters, such as Fukushima, they overshadow all these positive aspects. And one tends to forget that nobody actually died at Fukushima. It's one of those extraordinary things that people tend to forget there were no deaths right then due to the so-called disaster. It's interesting that the nuclear disaster, so-called, was such that it overshadowed the 20,000 who were killed in the tsunami, and those tend to be forgotten, and for that matter the way in which the Japanese coped with that particular disaster. Then I think there is a poor understanding of the true nature of nuclear hazards. There is some very interesting information about the way in which cities such as Nagasaki and Hiroshima have recovered from the nuclear disasters that were imposed on them 70 years ago or so. The general public, there is a widespread not in my backyard sense. It is, however, very interesting that in some places this has been overcome. The particular example is that of Sweden, where the government went out and said, we want somewhere to bury long-term nuclear waste. And the Swedish people looked at each other in the eye and said, well, can we have it, please? And when the award was finally made to one particular community, a community that had been left out, actually sued because it wanted the nuclear waste in its backyard. So it is possible that people can be, by proper information, by understanding the risk involved, and understanding the way in which risks can be mitigated and handled, then not in my backyard doesn't have to be the end of the road. There is concern about costs of nuclear power, and it's one of the very difficult things to talk about because the spread currently is so big. The Chinese costs are falling rapidly. The Swedish, the French experience in Finland is going the other way. That's going out of control. So that has given rise to a very big spread in the costs. The concern about safety, I think, is entirely misplaced, because if you actually look coolly at the energy industry and where the really big disasters come from, to your surprise, it's hydropower is the most dangerous next to coal. Coal is appalling in its safety record. Hydropower and the number of really big disasters that occur when dams break is much, much more serious than anything that nuclear has ever seen, including even Chernobyl. So there is concern about long-term waste. I think the concerns are misplaced because it's like the ash of any fire. They get cooler and cooler the longer you leave them around. They will still get, they're still warm after some time, but the warmth gets to a very, very low level quite quickly. And you know, people who are concerned about the fact that there's 100,000 year isotopes stuck in there, they shouldn't be concerned about that because you eat 100,000 year isotope each and every day, because if you don't, you die. And I mean, it's as simple as that. So the fact that we can actually eat radioactivity tends to be forgotten. That just goes to show how the long-term wastes are not the hazard that many people seem to think they are. There are some areas where there is, in the general public, a very positive response to the nuclear program, partly the fact that the lights do go out. Certainly in Cape Town there's a very real realization of the fact that when the lights went out, the unfortunate bolt got dropped into the generator and Cape Town's lights went out. Cape Town was suddenly reminded that it relies upon nuclear power. So there are areas where it's noted. And also there is a recognition in many, many areas that if you're worried about carbon, then the nuclear side of things certainly it shows a low carbon opportunity in a widespread use of nuclear power. As I say, there's also this by with other means of not yet managed to be demonstrated in practice, and I say that as an engineer. Education and training, there is already a reasonable level of high level skills in South Africa, largely as a result of the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor work, but by the time this program gets going along, certainly the high level skills will be aging, and we've got to do some renewal between now and then. And also, as I mentioned earlier on, there are the artisan skills that are very definitely short. Some tertiary institutions are already involved in training the next generation, however, so I don't think that this is really going to be a disaster. Certainly the fact that Kuberg is around and has spun off some industries as well is one of the great pluses that we actually have in this particular area. Coming to the environmental industry, I think it sees the program, the nuclear program, as a possible cash cow. You know, fund us and we will raise the protests for you. Some NGOs have already got quite large lobby groups in place and ready to start firing on all guns. The accent of much of this is on the perceived negative aspects of nuclear power. And I say perceived negative aspects, obviously, things like waste disposal and the severity of accidents. They downplay the need for base load, and they downplay, to my surprise, even the low carbon contribution that nuclear can make. But I think that if we can recognize and debate the possibility of mitigating the perceived negative aspects, then perhaps the environmental industry will come around to thinking that this is a good idea. And these are the conclusions that I must reach. I did some work for the International Atomic Energy Agency on a program called Energy Indicators for Sustainable Development, and many of these things I've reflected in what I've been saying here tonight. If you apply their tests to the constraints that we've identified here, I think we've got every chance of having a successful program in South Africa. I think we are in a reasonable state of readiness for what we're hoping to achieve. And perhaps it helps to remember that there are 67 nuclear reactors under construction right now. So this shows the nuclear power stations that are under construction. The world is actually building nuclear reactors in spite of Chernobyl, in spite of Fukushima. The rest of the world is going ahead. China, you will notice, is going ahead very heavily. That will, with any luck, chance, do a significant thing about mitigating its carbon emissions, which right now are growing by even more than South Africa's total output every year. So it will do something there. And it helps to reflect that the rest of the world is currently getting some 14%, as you've heard from the previous speaker, 14% of the world's electricity is coming from nuclear, versus I think it is less than 1% from windmills and less than 0.01% from solar thermal. So nuclear is already playing a significant part in keeping the world alive, warm, happy, and the lights switched on. And with that, thank you kindly.
Thank you very much, Prof, for that. Okay, can we move fast to Dr. Nacher? I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Can we settle over to Dr. Nacher?
Try again. I think I'm coming across almost as loud as before. Advancing for the better, stagnating or retrogressing is the topic given to me. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to proceed as follows. We're going to look at the worldwide scenario, but we will also look at the transition scenario. How do we extrapolate from what we see worldwide to the South African scenario? It would be useless to speak about the world all of the time if we do not know the South African readiness. Have we advanced? Have we stagnated? Have we and then I'm going to summarize. So we start with a worldwide scenario. The world energy perspective after Fukushima. Sources are the World Energy Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Two very good sources. There are many others out there which one don't always know if you believe it. Nuclear power plants are being programmed or will start being constructed. That's a fact. Some nuclear power plants are going to be rejuvenated following the post-Fukushima stress test. That is for the better. That's a good thing. Greater attention paid to aspects...
Can you go a little bit? I know we're really running out of time, but I think your second bullet point is worth elaborating a little bit on.
Some nuclear power plants being rejuvenated following post-Fukushima stress test. I think what has happened there is all the countries running nuclear in the world has gone back to the blackboard. They've gone back to analysis. They had a look at what would happen should a similar kind of natural disaster engulf one of their reactors. How can they mitigate against the outcome similar to what happened on the very old generation reactor in Fukushima? It will cost in terms of money. It will save in terms of security of mind. And therefore, it is an advancement for the better. Greater attention paid to aspects of safety and regulation, which is an outcome of that, clearly. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it will drive costs up moderately. Ambitious timelines for planning and construction and implementation will now have to become more realistic as a result of all these things. Alongside nuclear, there should be attempts to increase global governance of safe and environmentally friendly energy sources. This is exactly in line with the government's IRP 2010 orientation. From a safety and economic perspective, nuclear power plants will be improved for the better. Reactors under construction, Professor Lloyd just showed this slide here. There are lots of new builds. But the important thing I want to show on this graph is that there is growth, point number one. Secondly, that it's shifting from developed west to developing east. It is interesting that the developing countries are the ones picking up the banner for nuclear. For instance, if we look at Asia and the Middle East, they're sitting on oil and they're going nuclear. Now that is what I call long-term planning, because they're sitting on their medium-term future and they're planning for nuclear. Then the transition scenarios. How do we go from there to our global scenario? Let's do it by means of this graph. The primary energy per capita gigajoule on the y-axis and GDP per capita is there. Now we're going to ignore the US because they are energy gluttons. Let's rather look at a more realistic scenario. Where are we now? We're sitting there, which is not good. Where do we want to be if we are at all an ambitious nation? We don't have to be at the top. We need to be there. If we do the current new build, we're only going to be there. If we double it again, we're going to be there. After three doublings, we're in for business. This is the energy demand for a prospective view of a growing country. The South Africa scenario, we have to look at the need and the will and the ability. And this thing beautifully summarizes the symbolic scenario in South Africa. This little homestead in the middle of the Karoo, shall we say, in shale gas country. It sits there. And the potential here is human potential, vested in our people. Quality of life, if you wish, GDP per capita. There's a bit of wheat there, as you can see. Solar. This is the ambition of our people. There's a bit of fossil. They are hungry for training and information. And underneath all of that, there is a need for development. Training and capacity building is incredibly important, whichever vehicle propels it. So is innovation. So high technology vehicles are preferred. Nuclear energy is part of the baseload, an expansion with cognizance of greenhouse gas down management is, in a sense, a must for this vision. This was the 2010 scenario, and this is where we want to go. Nobody has shown it. I just remind you of it. And I'm going to concentrate there. I'm not going to try and argue about the relative ratios. They may be debatable in some people's mind, but let's stick to it for now, for the argument. I would say it's, apart from a little bit of changing in the ratios, it's a well-weighted, worldwide and locally tailored plan. So, have we advanced in the local scene? Have we stagnated or have we retrogressed? Let's see what government has done. Government's commitment, will and readiness. Look at everything that's been brought into place already on the nuclear scene. The nuclear energy plan, the integrated resource plan, the one we talk about here. Industrial policy plan, nuclear energy, research, development and innovation strategy. That's what that stands for. National Nuclear Energy Executive Coordination Committee, that's a long name. Funded IAEA nuclear readiness study, which the government paid for, and that was reported on in Engineering News. And they paid for the American Standards on Materials, ASME 3, should be a 3, sorry, I slipped one there, Manufacturing Standards Accreditation. I apologize for that, just fix it on the hard copies. And the National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute Act that was promulgated in January 2009. So preparing for the new world will need a lot of skills. Have we retrogressed? What have we done? Expansion of university courses in various nuclear and related fields has happened already. In fact, many of the sponsors from PBMR has played a role in this. PBR hasn't died a silent death. In a sense, it has gone underground and the roots there are spawning new sprouts. That's the right word. As long as it's not bean sprouts. NEASA harmonized the national curricula, training of industry staff locally and abroad through collaborative programs. So let's see about skills and supplying. I'll just show you what NEASA, this is a NEASA slide. Sorry, I borrowed it directly from you with your recognition as a source. And this is what the job creation looks like. It peaks at about 2,250. Now, one nuclear job is about 7 indirect jobs, which gives a job creation capacity of about 18,000 jobs. And therefore, you need training. So have we been sleeping on that, or have we done something? There's another 2,000 in utility engineering jobs. That's just to show you what a typical one nuclear power plant will do to the supplier demand. I'm just going to leave that up for a wee second or two so that you can just have a quick look at what it says. So let's look at technical skills training, postgraduate training, and localization preparation. We've got a special nuclear skills development program and center at the Nexus site where people can stay. Up to 250,000 people can be lodged there. And they are being, I exaggerated a wee bit. 250 people at a time can stay there. Technical computer-based skills and statutory skills on the safety side, shall we say it's on the center, on the computer side, and then on the hands-on know-how-to-do-it stuff. All these things are properly training accredited in ISO 9001:2008 accredited. Total trained is about 2,750 over the last 5 years. This is the demographics, as you can see. And as you can see, we're getting the ladies up to 50% of the, not manpower, of the human power in this case. Now, that's mechanical engineering. As you can see, I'm just showing you that there are activities. Electrical engineering, all sorts of things there. Fabrication, it doesn't mean the slide is fabricated. It just means that, as you can see, it's busy. So, I just wanted to page through a couple of slides to give you a bird's eye view of activity going on in the field of training. So what did we do about postgraduate training? There is the Masters in Applied Radiation Science and Technology and the Masters in Organized Science and Organization of Nuclear Energy. Then there are about 45 postgraduate students a year going through the NEXA facilities who do at least part of their projects on our beamline and other facilities which they would not have had access to the quality of research to enrich their course, we support another 42. Many of the old PBMR bursars were taken over by Nexa. So we're going on with this training exercise. Why do we do what the universities are supposed to do? It's not our mandate to train, it's the university's mandate. We do it because it's our strategy to be ready. The Masters in Science and Organization of Nuclear Energy, as you can see, there are, I just show you more or less an idea to show you the kind of intake we have. People coming through strongly in terms of the young people. Nuclear manufacturing, it was mentioned by Professor Lloyd in some areas. There are 82 posts in nuclear manufacturing at Nexa, 60,000 square meter, this time at East 1000, 60,000 square meter of workshop space, and we can handle up to 150 ton components. It is to boost localization, to be ready for localization, because it's a priority focus of government. And an important criteria in the IRP new build program. And it's a relatively easy way into localization using manufacturing. We will go for a phased approach and enable a localization to a certain extent even from the first unit and then learn from the learning curve impact assessment. Usually your second one, you do a bit better and a bit cheaper and a bit faster. So on. That's what that means. Nexa's approach then is to localize only identified products such as nuclear fuel components, specific nuclear fuel components, servicing maintenance requirements of nuclear power plants to be registered globally as a supplier, to also supply elsewhere in the world, and go into joint ventures as the NEP, the Nuclear Energy Plan, says, and to do it on a commercial basis. Go it into on that basis, and the nuclear manufacturing center is SME3 accredited, and these are all the certifications that it carries. The nuclear fuel cycle, materials beneficiation and globalization. Localization is a short-term thing, so one has to think global. South Africa has considerable deposits of uranium, fourth largest in the world. Calcium difluoride, amongst the top three. I think we may be top, but I hadn't had enough time to check there. But definitely amongst the top three. And zirconium, two large deposits. We still have uranium and fluoride chemistry capability platforms maintained. Waste management facilities and capabilities maintained. And these are all the ingredients for a sustainable nuclear power program. So, then to conclude, the nuclear power option is advancing safely and surely for the better, in my mind at least. Nuclear as part of the baseload mix remains a worldwide accepted solution to energy security whilst curbing greenhouse gas emissions. You would notice that I didn't really dwell on that. Because it doesn't really matter whether the scientists are wrong or right. It remains a fact that their consensus is a scientific case and not a political case. The South African government and nuclear industry has made substantial investments in training and localization already to be prepared and has to advance considerably towards a viable localization goal. If you go into a nuclear fuel cycle, it will cost you about only 10% of the cost of investing in nuclear power plants, with a vast localization potential. A nuclear fuel cycle program holds high promise for globalization of aspects of the nuclear power technology and massive job creation potential. IRP 2010, therefore, Mr. Chairman, may be debatable maybe with respect to some details, but is a wise approach from a global tendency and a local needs perspective. It encapsulates what we are and what we can do, what we are ready for, and what we need. And I think that may be my last slide. You wanted me to say something about...
Yes, please.
Chairman asked me to say something about PBMR chemistry, a little bit of a surprise. But now I need to do that. So I'm going to say about five or six sentences about PBMR. I think PBMR in principle was a great idea. If it was approached a little bit more modestly, with a phased approach, with a smaller and more conventional demo model, I believe it might have had completely different outcome. That's the first point I want to make, because it would have made licensing so much easier. People license things that they understand much better than innovations. It had an excellent value case, really, if it would have come to fruition. Very low on water consumption, a very valuable commodity in our country. Modular, cost effective in that sense, and it can be brought to where the energy was required. It had the potential for delocalized process heat and a hydrogen economy, the basis of a hydrogen economy. A lot of training came out of it, engineering skills, lots of even manufacturing skills, all valuable for a future nuclear engineering architect function in our country. We took up many of the students, many of the skills, and we are building on those, as you could see in the nuclear manufacturing in training. And that, Chairman, I think is about the only thing I would
Thank you very much, Dr. Lamphan. I would like us not to go beyond seven in inputs. Now let's have Ms. Nogwedi, the last input, please. I see from an presentation there are a couple of areas that have already been covered, if you could just take note of that.
Good evening, and thank you very much for the opportunity. And if I was going to be naughty, I'd say my entire presentation has been presented, but I have to justify why I've come to Cape Town, so I have to proceed with my presentation. Good evening, Honourable Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, and all members who have pitched today as stakeholders. The slides I will present have reams of data behind it, so they are high level. Just a little bit about the Nuclear Industry Association of South Africa. We are a collection of members that range from academic institutions, research bodies, international vendors, local vendors, utilities, academic institutions, and centers of higher learning, and we bring together the best of best in South Africa with regard to nuclear, and not only nuclear power and nuclear energy, but all forms of nuclear. Since NECSA borrowed from NEASA, I'd like to just share something else about South Africa's nuclear capability, and that is that we are the world's number one isotope producer, something that has set us as a country apart from many other global players. We as NEASA have been asked to present some of the key global learnings as well as and to provide a continental perspective. So if you will allow me to just extract some of the most pertinent points with regard to the global energy outlook for 2013, China accounts for more than 40% of the global net increase in nuclear capacity. 17 reactors built, 32 in various stages of construction. The company that I work for, we are in partnership, and the Chinese are licensing some of our technology for their new builds. This point has been covered, but I'd like to reiterate that renewable energy and nuclear power are the world's fastest growing energy sources, each increasing by 2.5% per year. However, fossil fuels continue to supply almost 80% of the world's energy use at least until 2040, and this has all kinds of implications alluded to by previous presenters. Natural gas is the fastest growing fossil fuel in the outlook, supported by increasing supplies of shale gas, particularly in America, and many parts of Africa, Southern Africa in particular, have also indicated high levels of interest in fast-tracking gas as an option in respective countries. Coal continues to grow faster than petroleum consumption until after 2030, mostly due to increases in China's consumption of coal and slow growth in oil demand in OECD countries. World electricity demand is likely to grow by over 80% by 2040, and nuclear energy capacity will need to double. Nuclear energy in India needs to be a significant part of the mix if their consumption requirements are to be met with a requirement of electricity supply by 625% in order to meet their development goals. Worldwide, energy-related carbon dioxide emissions are projected to increase by 46% by 2040, reaching 45 billion metric tons in 2040. And of course, the point about the contribution of nuclear in terms of a low carbon footprint has been eloquently and adequately made by previous speakers. Now let's look at what's happening on the African continent. At the moment, South Africa is the only player in nuclear generation, but we must of course remember that the first nuclear in situ occurrence occurred in Gabon, in West Africa. So in a way, nuclear energy, the epicenter of the origin of nuclear, is on the African continent. We are noticing an increased will and political commitment by many African countries to advance the application of nuclear technology for power generation. Nigeria is seen as making real progress towards the introduction of nuclear power, having started up its first research reactor in 2004. NEASA, of course, has partnered with many different countries in Africa, as well as NECSA, in terms of different African countries coming to South Africa to learn from our own experience. And of course, our national nuclear regulator is held in high esteem across the continent. And whilst nuclear power stations have not been built, many countries already have national nuclear regulators, because in order to build, you need the regulator to be in place. I'm not going to deal with the NEC squared, as we call it. That's been adequately covered as well. Now, in terms of the global perspective of when it comes to nuclear, there are 3 to 4 key questions universally that are asked. And each country and each continent answers these questions very differently, depending on whether you're a developing economy, an emerging economy, or a mixed economy. So the key considerations are as follows. Is it safe? Is it affordable? Is there a measure and process for accountability and transparency in the procurement process? Can the public be convinced? Will they buy into the option? Will they contest for the plants to be built in their provinces, in their states? And when I come to that particular bullet point, I will share with you different countries' experiences in how competitive the bid process is to have a nuclear power plant in a territory. So first and foremost, is nuclear an option? How viable is it? There are many issues surrounding nuclear power, notwithstanding safety and waste management. So the question globally really is, which are the issues that we should be worried about? So first and foremost, there are questions like, are we likely to run out of uranium? Why should we consider nuclear energy when sun and wind are effectively free and will be with us forever? Why not cheap base load, coal and or gas? What are the risks and the implications of going nuclear beyond environmental? What are the financial implications of going nuclear? NECSA put the case, as well as Prof. Lloyd, around, can South Africa do it? Are we ready? So if you allow me to break all the speeding fines, I'll go and quickly answer all these questions. And as I said, there is sufficient data to back up and to provide to the portfolio committee to unpack each of these thematics. No, there is not enough uranium. However, with breeder reactors and thorium resources, we have enough fuel for maybe thousands of years to come. What are the implications? And I think some of the issues addressed around safety, radiation levels of exposure, the disasters thus far, the accidents thus far, I think Prof. Lloyd has adequately covered these. And so I'll just conclude by saying the implications for nuclear are very favorable relative to other technologies. Incidentally, I grew up in the Western Cape between two power stations, one coal and one nuclear. And the community that I came from, we were far more in favor of nuclear than coal, because coal contaminated our communities from the time you woke up in the morning to the time you went to bed at night, just in terms of its pollutant effect. Whereas with regard to Coburg, we didn't even know it was there. It provided us with electricity, because when I grew up, despite the fact of having two power plants in our backyard, we had no electricity. So let me leave it at that, because the next build of nuclear power stations, all South Africans will have equal and universal access to electricity. Effectively, no CO2, vastly better than coal, visually acceptable, no land contamination. Base load is the need, and base load is critical for an economy like South Africa that is determined to become more industrialized and to have a solid manufacturing base in order to become globally competitive. Why should we tangle with nuclear energy when sun and wind are effectively free and will be with us forever? Well, actually, they are far from free. But be that as it may, South Africa does have an abundance of sun, and so the energy mix really has to be diverse energy sources made up of sun, wind, hydro, waste to energy, including nuclear. With regard to the financial implications, and I deliberately changed this from cost to the financial implications, because this in many ways goes to the core of what South Africa is grappling with at the moment. It is a very difficult question to answer, because whether you're looking at capital costs, front-end costs, costs during the life cycle of the build, levelized costs, there are so many different modalities and modeling that has to go into it. But given capital and operating costs, best as we know them, the only way, Chair, to you and the Portfolio Committee, to really find out what the true financial implications are, is to issue inquiry documents to various potential participants in a nuclear new build. I would like to say, though, that the delays around going nuclear, the decision-making processes, the regulatory challenges, these are some of the hidden costs that lead to cost overruns that then redefine the actual cost of a nuclear new build. Now, in terms of what do we know about the high cost of capital for nuclear infrastructure, the power plant itself, the engineering of the power plant, from the beginning to the end, in terms of an EPC, that's quite finite, and those costs can be very, and we can present those costs. The associated industrial development, employment creation opportunities that are transformational at a level beyond comprehension. If we look at South Korea, 60 years of development. South Korea is a leading economy globally at the moment, and it's almost singularly attributed to a decision they made 60 years ago to go nuclear. They sent 200 young engineers to America. They were given one ultimatum: if you don't want to come back, jump off the boat before it arrives at America, because once you land in America, all 200 of you will come back. They came back, and today South Korea is what it is. But it was the decision twofold, the scientification of South Koreans and the decision to go global. I must also say that nuclear provides, which has not been talked about, it provides a country and an economy with a whole different differentiator in terms of where you play. Nuclear has the power to completely take a country into a different level of knowledge and in terms of knowledge and the economy. But let me say that the single greatest cost, the single greatest cost to any economy and its citizens is no electricity. Joburg experienced 4 days without electricity, almost 7 days without electricity. I cannot begin to share with all of us in the room what that has done to Johannesburg. Can South Africa do it? Yes, of course we can do it. Coburg has been a success. Why can't we do it again? And there are many different views on why and how you can do it. We don't have the time to delve into that today. But I absolutely believe that the youth and the young engineers and scientists, together with some of the geniuses and our experts on the other side there, together youth and wisdom, we can do it. The biggest area, of course, and the opportunity is public engagement, public participation, and there are different models around the world, but in many countries, it is actually the public that drives the need for nuclear new builds, believe it or not. The process thus far, from an EASA point of view, we believe that all over the world, the private sector, both big and small, have played a pivotal role in any nuclear new build. And with all the processes underway in South Africa at the moment, we are seeing a distinct gap in the place and the space for a private sector dialogue with government. It is the private sector that builds. It is the private sector that has been building. And it is the private sector, together with enterprises across the value chain, that continues to build. How can we proceed with the new build without a constructed, structured dialogue with the private sector, the people who do the building? Policy is an enabler, but the people who build have to be part of this dialogue, and it's glaringly lacking, unfortunately, Chair. So in conclusion, we have reached a suspended moment in our energy history. What will be the legacy, ours as NEASA, your legacy as the committee, our future inclusive growth and development requirements? We are caught between an intractable present and irrecoverable past, between things that are no longer and things that are not yet. So let's be brave. And as my former boss always says, nuclear is not the answer, but it has to be part of the answer. I will share with you two closing slides, and I will leave you to guess which city this is. But 75 years ago, this country and this site was decimated, and this is what it looks like today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nobedi. The apologies for people for taking so long. I will open up now for discussions, but in opening up for discussions, I will allow the first respondent, if there's a first respondent, Dr. Stefan Day, if you have a couple of questions, to also add to Dr. Stefan Day, because he made a plea that he wanted to share a few things with us, but you've got exactly 5 minutes.
Factor 100 and got 0.2 South African cents per kilowatt hour,
The same is unfortunately not true for coal. Coal is internationally the lowest figure that I could get for the environmental damage. I use the lowest figure because South Africa is less densely populated than Europe, so you will have less damage here than in Europe. So I found 2 European cents per kilowatt hour, which gives you 26 South African cents per kilowatt hour. When I put all of this in here, and now I don't know how to point on this thing, but the how do you point with this?
You're losing 5 seconds.
Okay, all right, don't worry about that. So the yellow line is the nuclear, the lowest cost. The pink line is nuclear, that very high capital cost. And then the brown line on top is coal. If you take a high view of its environmental damage, and the white line is coal if you take only carbon tax, as the South African plan at the moment prescribes. And what you can see here is on the x-axis is the post-tax real weighted average cost of capital. So that's what it costs you to borrow money and what you have to pay to your person that supplies your capital for. That would be for the South African government as the owner of Eskom. So the figures that was used at the National Planning Commission was the very high cost, that is 8%. As you can see there, the pink one goes on top. So if you have a very high cost of your capital, then because nuclear is very capital intensive, you get really high prices for the electricity that you produce. But if you use the 3.12% that NERSA prescribed to Eskom in the last application of that, you will find that even the most expensive form of nuclear that we have in this calculations is cheaper than the cheapest form of coal that we have here. So you just see that is the problem. It's not how expensive nuclear is, but it's what do you pay per rand that you borrow that kills the program or not. So then I compared the worst case nuclear with the best case coal that I could have here. So the brown one, red one is the coal. So you then see for a high selling price of electricity, you make more profit with the or more higher percentage return with coal, but and vice versa, for a lower price, selling price, you make a higher percentage with nuclear. But a very important thing that I want to point out to you is we shouldn't think in percentages, because the capital cost of nuclear is twice that of coal. So if you make the same percentage profit on a nuclear plant than on a coal plant, you are actually making double the nominal, the amount of rand that you get is double. So in the next slide, which is my last slide, the last result, I then work it out as actual money that you get the nominal return, and you then see that for all the prices that I used, nuclear outperforms coal, or the least profitable nuclear outperforms the most profitable coal plant that we could do here. So my conclusion is that the environmental cost of a nuclear is more than 10 times less than that of coal. The levelized cost of electricity of nuclear is less than coal, provided that the cost at which you get the capital is less than 5%, and that's really something that you can do. And the worst case nuclear is more profitable than the best case coal plant that we that I simulated here, which comes from the IRP. So basically, if you go to the effort to make the capital cost low, nuclear will win hands down. On am I past my 5 minutes?
Yes, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Hands, please. If we could introduce yourself, that where you come from, that would be very helpful. I'll start on this side. I'll have to number you. 1, 2, down your hand. No. This lady first, and then the gentleman next to her. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This side for now.
Good evening, Honorable Chair, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to keep my...
If you could introduce yourself.
I know we're eager to speak.
My name is Chris Bellingham. I work for UV Renewable Energies. It is the largest solar construction company in the world and the most successful wind developer in Europe last year. And I would like to talk about the price of energy. The U.S. Energy Administration...
You've got exactly 1 minute. Rico, will have to be timekeeping.
Okay, 1 minute. All right, so we've got levelized costs for nuclear energy as estimated by the U.S. of around 15, excluding decommissioning. That goes up to 8 rand per kilowatt hour, including decommissioning. We're sitting at energy prices in South Africa for wind and solar. Wind sitting at around 86 cents, including economic development commitments. You've got solar sitting at around a rand, including economic development commitments. So if you had to take those same levelized prices for nuclear, add on your economic development commitments, as would be the case in South Africa, and I think you'd be sitting in an extremely expensive form of electricity. When you take into consideration the tender program that would need to be initiated for South Africa, you would need an extremely large tender program for nuclear energy to be viable in this country. And I believe if it were to be the case, South Africa would be handcuffed to an outdated technology leading into the future, leaving us without the benefit of cutting-edge technology and future thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Number two. Exactly 1 minute, please.
Yes, my name is Katharina Skippers. I'm a parent, and I'm a person who respects this planet and nature. That's where I'm coming from. And I want to say that nobody died in Fukushima, anybody who says that loses all credibility, because old people died because they could not be evacuated in time, and there were lots of suicides. There are people that are busy dying. That's my one point. The other point is that you're talking about all this, but it took 40 years to get a evacuation plan for us, and I've went to the exercise, and it was clear that it's a pipe dream, because the whole plan was based upon the fact that there was going to be enough willing bus drivers that's going to take people out. And then I've spoken to bus drivers from Golden Arrow, that was the deal, and they don't know anything about it. It's not legal to send people in a contaminated area to evacuate. So it's not legal to send them if they don't, in this danger, if they don't know about it or agree. And to add, in the point of an actual emergency, to then brief them and convince them to do that, that's going to take longer than the people are going to be contaminated already. And there's 3.5 million people in Cape Town in this area. If what happens at Fukushima...
Thank you. Number three... Microphone, please.
Sorry. Okay. Ross Harvey from the South African Institute for International Affairs. Chair, thanks for the opportunity. I have a brief quote from a recent article by Anthony Eberhardt from the National Planning Commission. It says, a global survey of nuclear development finds that only 13 countries are currently constructing nuclear energy reactors. 5 of these countries, and this is them, have uncompleted reactors whose construction started as far back as the 1980s. There's also a great book by Daniel Kahneman called Thinking, Fast and Slow, in which he goes to great lengths to describe planning fallacies. And it seems to me that tonight we've heard a great deal of hopeful planning fallacies. It seems to me that nuclear plans are going to lock us into a high capital cost future that reduces our flexibility and responsiveness. So I really just wanted to put on record to caution that, in fact, I think we need to be aware of what's going on globally. More aware, it seems to me, than the speakers have been, frankly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Number four.
Thank you for the opportunity, Chair. My name is Jan Glazewski, Professor in the Institute of Marine and Environmental Law at the University of Cape Town. At the outset, I must say I'm not either for or against nuclear. I want to make four short points. Number one, I'm concerned that we've heard some four or so persuasive pro-discussion, pro-presentations on nuclear, but we haven't heard anything, a presentation against nuclear. And as we all know, there's a number of very lively NGOs in South Africa, and I'm wondering if the portfolio committee invited them. Point number two, there was a reference to life cycle costs, and I'm wondering whether the cost of the long-term cost of high-level radioactive waste is brought into that, how to deal with that. I also want to draw the attention to the portfolio committee that our environmental right in the Constitution guarantees the right of future generations, and it seems to me we don't have a plan for dealing with high-level radioactive waste. In fact, I don't know if any country in the world has, and are we not derogating from this environmental right? My point number three is reference was made to the nuclear energy policy of 2008. I would like to know if that policy has been revisited in the light of Fukushima, and if so, how is it being revisited?
Thank you.
Sorry, can I make one last point, very brief? Fourthly, in the costs, has any consideration been made to liability and who's going to underwrite the risk? So the African government can't underwrite the risk of environmental damage from acid mine drainage. Who's going to underwrite the risk of a nuclear accident?
Five.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Selim Fakir. I'm the shale gas lobbyist. I'm actually teasing. I work for the Worldwide Fund for Nature. And I don't, I've never eaten any radioactivity in my life, so I don't know how it tastes. But I do want to raise a couple of questions around the demand curve, and there is a lot of debate about that. And I think the reason that it's important is that it will tell us whether we need nuclear power or not. And so I think it's very important to understand what that's going to look like in the next 20, 30 years. And that could determine whether we need nuclear or the entire bulk program that is envisaged here. I think I happened to be with Anton Eberhard in a meeting in March with a couple of Swedes, and I've never heard them say anything about nuclear that is as positive as Professor Lloyd has just accounted for. In fact, they have been mentioning...
Mr. Saki, actually, you've got 10 seconds left.
Yeah, sure. But a couple of things. It will be interesting to know the procurement process, the bidding process, how that's going to happen, who's going to finance it, what are the guarantees going to look like, what is the cost of capital that we can attract for the nuclear industry. Is it really going to be 5%, less than 5%, or is it going to be more? And what is the discount
Unfortunately,
rate?
Thank
What's
you.
The discount rate?
I've really given you more than 1 minute. I don't want to be unfair to other people. Number six.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mona Lakhani. I represent Tsunami, which is a coalition of more than 60 South African civil society, environmental, social, and economic justice groupings. For the record, we're not part of the environmental industry. We don't even have a bank account. I'd also like to correct the nuclear industry. The global electricity generation by nuclear currently is 10%, not 40%. They haven't hit 14% since probably 5 years ago. We just want to make 3 points in one quotation. I think the question we have actually is, when do we get a chance to have four of us who don't agree with nuclear having the opportunity that was offered to the pro-nukes people today? But global investment decisions hovering around $300 billion is going towards renewable energy, but nuclear hasn't peaked above $50 billion yet. So we think that's worthy of a bit of thinking. Around death, when you look at what the Russians have done, because it was written in Russian, probably we ignored it, but Nabokov and others have confirmed that the impact, total impact from Chernobyl in short, medium, and long-term cancers and such like is heading close to 1 million people. So just because it didn't kill people at the time, Fukushima holds the potential to kill many more. If you look at the electricity generation in the world, China was being held up as one of our BRICS connections that we need to draw with in the same playing field. They have hit 100 terawatt hours per year with both wind and solar, and they have yet to hit more than 5 terawatt hours per year with electricity. So I think that's something
Thank
worth
you.
Thinking about. The quote, if I may, Chair. Steve
Thank
Pitt,
you.
The Director of Strategy and Research.
Thank you, sir.
The World Nuclear
excuse
Association.
Excuse me.
What is clear is that
excuse
it is completely
me. Excuse
impossible.
Me, sir. Excuse
Four
me.
Four more words, please,
Excuse
Chair.
Me. I'm running the meeting. Number 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Without being disrespectful to you, Mr. Chairperson, and members of your committee, but I must say, and I'm from the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, I really thought coming here to the stakeholders meeting would be given much more, you know, much more time and opportunities to actually engage in these debates. And I must say I am concerned that 1 minute is very, very limited. Having said that, and I want to do this, and I'm going to do this very quickly, we've had 4 probe presentations here, and I want to say COSATU adopted a resolution at its 11th Congress last year representing 2 million workers in this country saying no to nuclear. And I want to make that very, very clear. Secondly, and I want to get this noted, in the first presentation we were told that renewables will make up 42%. I think there's a bit of a mistake there. It's actually 9%. It's 42%. That 9% actually constitutes 42% of new build capacity. So it's not really 42%. Last point I want to make is we believe that there should be a critical mass. If there's a critical mass of renewables, and this is where the debate is that the allocation is so small. It's like piecemeal. It's very fragmented. You've got to have a critical mass, and then we can really talk seriously. I think my one minute is up, but I must appeal, and I'm sure others would support me. I think those on the other side should be given a little bit more time to make their points.
On the left-hand side. Can I see the hands very clearly? Okay. Funisi, number 1. Number 2, sir. Number 3. Number 4. Number 5.
Bishop Jeff Davies from the Faith Communities Environment Institute. Mr. Chair, I wanted to thank you very much for this opportunity, but I'm actually extremely disturbed now. You know that the Faith Communities and the Electricity Governance Initiative asked if we could give a presentation on the Smart Electricity Plan, which has been really researched, and it's a 100-page in-depth document. So I would ask, as others have, that we have renewable energy as an option for sustainable supply of energy. And we have the opportunity of PowerPoint presentations. I am pretty appalled at the biased, prejudiced views that I have seen today on nuclear energy. And I think we need an opportunity of putting the other side. The Scientific American published in 2009 all the energy we need from wind, sun, and water by 2030 for the world. The Economist magazine published in 2012 that nuclear energy has priced itself out of consideration.
Time is up. Number 2.
Good evening, Chairperson. Thank you for this opportunity. A lot of what this nuclear program depends on is whether we actually need the additional power. And that, of course,
can you please introduce yourself first?
I beg your pardon. My name is David LePage. I'm a journalist, a citizen, a taxpayer, and a voter. There have, since the IRP 2010 was developed, there have been at least 4 studies which have produced dramatically reduced projections for electricity demand in this country. I won't go into the details since there's very little time. But there's the University of Pretoria study by Ruler and Glacey. There's the Energy Research Centre study done for the NDP. There's the CSIR study. And there's the study from the Association of Science for South Africa. I want to skip on to an issue which I think is very close to the hearts of everybody who cares about this country, which is jobs. Professor Lloyd referred to 100,000 jobs information that there are 58 nuclear reactors in France. So we would have to have a great many more nuclear reactors before we got anywhere near 100,000 jobs. All the evidence from Germany and the United States with advanced renewable energy programs is that renewable energy creates many more jobs. When we had the arms deal in this country, which led to an enormous amount of capital leaving this country, it has been estimated by the Institute for Security Studies that that lost us up to 1 million jobs as a consequence of the 62 billion rand that was spent on the arms deal. Depending on localization, of course, we can't predict the amount of capital that will leave the country to build our nuclear program, but we can be pretty darn certain that that capital would keep a whole lot more jobs in the country if it were to stay here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've only given me 1 minute, so I'm going to have to talk very quickly.
Peter Baker from?
The Kuberg Alert Alliance,
okay.
NGO. So I'm going to have to talk very quickly to stay in my 1 minute. I'd also like to repeat the fact I'm very disturbed. We've had 3 sales pitches today from the nuclear industry, and in fact disingenuous sales pitches as well, full of factual errors. I don't have time to mention them all, so let me mention one. You mentioned, a few of you, that 14% of the world's energy is from nuclear power. That's not true. There's 12.3 currently, and there's a website you can get it from. It's called google.com, and you'll be able to find the up-to-date information there. So it is really worrying, the quality of your academic research, that you stand in front of Parliament and give them incorrect information that you seem to be unable to find on the web. But that's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the National Waste Management Agency, which is a very, very big concern to me. This is an agency which, by international pattern, will actually have its funds raised from a levy on the nuclear energy that's produced. However, there's no funds at the moment, so there's no staff. So there's no mechanism to create the levy, to create the agency to handle the waste. So what's happening is we're always being told it's 5 years in the future. And this is something that needs an urgent intervention from Parliament in order to get that process started.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Andrew Kenny. I'm an environmentalist and an engineer. I believe we've got a moral duty to protect our planet, and therefore I think we've got a moral duty on behalf of the planet for bulk energy, for bulk electricity, to turn to nuclear power, because nuclear power has been proved by far the safest source of energy that mankind has ever found. It is not true that 1 million people died at Chernobyl. The actual figure is about 65, confirmed by a massive multinational study. Nuclear power is all around the world economic and often the cheapest form of power. It's the cleanest form of energy we know. It's got the least waste problem. Every single energy technology, including solar and wind, produces waste, lasts for thousands of millions of years.
Unfortunately, thank you, Mr. Kenny. Yes, the last one.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Can you take your mic off, Mr. Andrew?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and everybody. I'm Don Mingay. I'm a nuclear physicist by training, an environmentalist as a heart. My head is nuclear. And what I do want to do is, first of all, I wish people would stop referring to Google and look at the international literature for their numbers, because I am at odds with several of the statements that have been made here this afternoon. I think people should do their homework more in a scientific way rather than in a consensus way. Secondly, it is interesting to see that, for instance, solar PV is being put in Gauteng by the state at 37,000 rand per kilowatt capital cost. Good heavens, that's the same as nuclear, isn't it? It's going ahead. It's interesting to see that in the bid windows for PV, there are something like 260-odd cents per kilowatt hour. Rubbish. Where's this other answer? All you have to do is look up in the bid windows, which are in nuclear energy. Energy news. And my point here is that people should look at the numbers and not at the faith. Not look at what they feel is the right thing to do, but get the hard numbers and work on them.
Unfortunately, Prof, thanks very much.
hand over back to the presenters, I can only... Oh. I didn't see the hands of Honorable MBs. I thought they were going to, they wanted to listen only. I trust you appreciate why I wanted the audience first so that I can allow you, but then I didn't see your hands. Now it's your turn, Honorable Members.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say, I mean, I did actually come here intending to just to listen, but I do actually want to put it on record that I think I haven't worked out what the point of this meeting is, because I hear what people's complaints are here. There's a big debate around nuclear in South Africa, and I think to have 2.5 hours of presentations from one side and to allow only a minute for people to present their arguments on the other side is not conducive to a proper debate. And I think that all this does is it shows an inherent bias and does not take this debate further. I came here with an open mind. I wanted to hear both sides. I wanted to see this debate take place, and unfortunately it hasn't. And I think I do need to put it on record, because I am embarrassed as a member of this committee that all of these people are here and they can't have a proper debate over this particular issue.
With due respect, Honorable Hreling, you are assuming that those who are, as you call pro-nuclear, are the ones who are making presentation, and everybody else is anti. Yes. Honorable Khradebe, I'm putting it on record as well.
Well, thanks, Chair. My name is Yusufu Khradebe, a member of Parliament and a member of this portfolio committee. Chair, one, you know, we should avoid clapping hands when a person raises a fact that, you know, pleases you. Because that doesn't create unity. You are trying... Here we are members of parliament. We must unite South Africans. And we must unite people that want to raise their views. We must accept that people raise their particular views and their particular views. But I believe that as a portfolio committee, we should allow probably the chairperson to arrange probably another meeting that will have ample time for all of us to have a debate around this matter, because it will be very unfair that when others, you know, raise other issues and the others are not fair, and I feel as if they don't do that fairly. Well, members of parliament want this matter to be debated. It's a continuous debate that is also happening. I very feel that Chair, probably you must find time that you must arrange another meeting and engage fairly about this matter. I think that would be best. But you should avoid that when one raises a point that favors you, then you clap hands like you are in a rally. We are solving a big case of South Africa here. That must make sure that South Africa have this electricity that today we are enjoying this electricity because of Quebec. It's one of the other issues that we must be able to debate and engage around this matter, rather than ourselves fighting against each other as if we can't be able to find solutions. Let's find solutions for South Africans. Thank you.
Just to say I'm tempted to respond. Just a matter of record. I said this is the 6th energy stakeholders meeting. 5 of them here. 1 was in Durban. And that was the only one that had nothing to do with renewable energy. I think you should take note of that. All of them that were held here, the 5 of them, one way or another, had something to do with renewable energy. And I was doing that because I was responding to inputs, persuasions from various people. Okay. Can I allow the presenters to respond quite briefly, because we are going to take another round. And we're going to take another round if the presenters are able to respond as crisply as possible. Honorable Khadeb, I've taken your point, but I think as a matter of reinforcing what you're saying, is that out of 6, 4, sorry, because this one is nuclear, 4 had, it was all about renewable energy, whatever slant and angle it was, but it was about renewable energy. Anyone wants to start?
About that, Prof. Dr. Nachael, Sister Judy, I'm sure you've taken notes. Just be ready. Maybe the real debt, kick off.
Thank you, Chair. I will respond to those specific questions that related to the presentation I made. So the first question was around the current demand curve. And the statement that was made, I think it's the gentleman from World Wildlife. He stated that, you know, if the demand curve comes out to be lower than what is currently in the IRP, we might therefore not need a nuclear plant. And my response to that is fairly simple. When the indications, and I'm talking about now a proper work that needs to be done to revise the demand curve, I think we need to take into account that all these other so-called reviews of the current curve, the methodology that is followed to produce those curves, first of all, it's restricted to certain institutions, right? It's not as open to the public for scrutiny as the current IRP demand curve was. So that's the first point that we must note. So assuming that the demand curve in the revised IRP comes lower than the current one, then the next logical step is to answer the question of what types of energy mix do we need for South Africa to meet this newly revised, albeit reduced, demand curve. You know, that does not mean that nuclear will not be part of it. It could not be part of it. But let us not preempt what the energy mix will look like based on some assumptions around our electricity demand for the future. That's the first point I want to raise. The second one, in terms of the figures that I used in my presentation, I want to clarify that, Chair. The presentation is very clear that if you take today as day zero, for the next 20 years, the new power plants that will come to connect to the grid, 42% of the new build is renewable energy. The numbers are there. I mean, it's not 9%. 9% is the total figure, including the ones that were connected before today. If you take today as day zero, for the next 20 years, we will commission 42% based on the current version of the IRP. And in effect, it's there in the numbers. If you want the report, you can share that. Chair, the other issue was around the 14% of electricity being generated from nuclear. We have quoted in our presentation the source of that, and it's not Google. I mean, the gentleman from Mr. Khan indicated that his own assessment is 10%. Shortly thereafter, you get Mr. Peter Baker saying his assessment based on Google is 12.3%. I'm saying if there is a reputable source, then put it on the table so that people can go and read the reports themselves. So we have projected 14% based on a reputable research, and the report is available for consumption. The question from, well, the comment from Bishop Davis around South Africa needing to focus only on renewable energy as the source of electricity generation. South Africa is a heavily industrialized economy. We need base load, and it's a fact. We cannot run away from that. Until the point where renewable energy is able to provide and cost-efficiently so, to provide base load, we cannot say a mine will only be able to go to send people underground during the day when there is sun or during windy days when there is wind. We need a mix. Renewable energy is there to serve a particular purpose. Until the point where the cost and the dispatchability of these renewable plants is able to assist the South African economy to grow from today to where we want it to be. Unfortunately, we need base load, and the current technologies that provide base load, yes, CSP might to some extent is either gas, coal, or nuclear. Right? We don't have sufficient hydro resource. We rely on importing it. And we don't want to expose the South African economy to global politics at this stage. Chair, I've answered the question around the four studies revising the IRP demand focus. I'm saying read those reports, understand the formulation
and up the speed,
and compare that with what the IRP's formulation is. And we are open to inputs. We are next week, as it says, we are going out for public consultation on the revised assumptions that will influence the next version of the IRP. Let us be honest. I mean, it's pointless to sit in your office, develop some counter IRP report, and you present it as the alternative to the IRP, based on the process that only you and a few people understand. You know what went into. I mean, we know that there are lobby groups and all of that. But I'm saying, for the benefit of the country, let us be honest and let us influence the process correctly. So, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairman. I want to react on a couple of points. Thanks for clearing up the previous meetings. I wasn't there because I also had some concern that it might come across a little bit one-sided. I agree with that. But nevertheless, let's go to a couple of things that I wish to talk about. The one, I just want to quickly address the costing in the simplest possible way, in a way that may be an oversimplification, I admit, but I don't have time. If I have a years of modeling with variable input scenarios and one reality check, I'll choose the second one every day of the week. The French have 75% of their energy from nuclear and they're fifth GDP country in the world. Now you may debate on that's a simplistic thing, but we should do the reality checks and the sums which we do not have time for to substantiate this simplistic view. Secondly, I want to talk about the wasting, which is, of course, something of a great concern to the public. Again, there is a public, shall we say, almost an environmental public concern about waste, which has been the biggest barrier towards a solution to waste. Because the technology is there, again, it's a bit too technical to go into the detail. It is well understood. It's now 100 years of nuclear science and technology that went into the understanding of this. And the solution is there. We have to find each other in finding the socio-economic solution to the problem because the science solution exists. Then I'm almost finished. I wanted to address a couple of points. Let's just see what the other questions was that I put down here. Okay. The point I wanted to make, sorry, there was another thing here. The question that came up, I just wanted to check which one it was the concern that the environmental side didn't get a good hearing. I immediately want to say, I wanted to make it clear in my presentation that the nuclear industry is not anti-environmental sources. We're for a balanced approach. We just also want to put on the table a caution not to overreact emotionally to the point where we exclude completely from consideration a baseload source which can enrich this country in soul and in spirit and economically and wipe it off the table in one clip statement. And therefore, we're with you. Bear with us. But we have to find each other for a wise national solution. Thank you, Chair.
Just be careful of saying we. There is a government position. Yes, there is a government position. And I did not create this platform to create any innuendo or inference that we're going to change that government position. Who am I? Isn't it? Let's be blunt and open and frank. There's a government position. It's part of IRP. Are we here to change it? I would like someone to tell me. But still, we're not going to block a platform for people to express themselves, isn't it? Let's be honest about that. We can't, by inference or by event or whatever, create platforms that are going to undermine government's programs.
But at the same time, if it be, we in a very structured and appropriate way allow platforms for people to express themselves.
Prof? Sorry to pass it because I should have given you. I would like to respond to a number of points that were made. First of all, Chris Bellingham made an extraordinary statement concerning the price of nuclear power, including the cost of decommissioning. And I'd like to invite him to give his email address so that I can send him the paper, chapter and verse of actually what the costs of decommissioning are from somebody who's doing decommissioning on a large state in the United States. It's of the order of cents, not rands, the kilowatt hour. Katrina Skippers said that the fact that some people who were being moved from the immediate vicinity of Fukushima meant that I was wrong when I said that no people died at Fukushima. That was a movement by the Japanese government that might not necessarily have been in the best possible interest of everybody concerned. So I think that it's unfortunate to try and target the nuclear industry with the Japanese government's decision, which actually had nothing to do with the actual operation and the generation of power by the power plants themselves. I stand by the statement I made earlier on that no person died as a result of the radioactive activity at Fukushima. Two people, in fact, did die at Fukushima due to the tsunami. They were drowned in the basement. The gentleman, Nick Fortune, I think it was, from WWF, said that he would not eat anything radioactive. I'm afraid he was able to speak. If he did not eat something radioactive, he would not be able to speak, because at the core of our nervous system is an element called potassium. An element called potassium is actually radioactive, and the nervous system operates on the exchange between sodium and potassium. So I'm amazed he's able to overrule the simple physics of the universe, because it's just not true.
Well, we are not a medical doctor.
No, but I do know my radiation physics. And as regards the NUMSA comments that it was unfortunate that there was only 9% of our future build was going to be renewable, I think that is a very wise decision, because we have to remember that most of this renewable energy is a new technology. It is an unproven technology. The windmills that we're building are typically more than 2 megawatts in power. Those are only about 5 years old. They haven't had much operational experience yet. We're putting in 100 megawatts of solar thermal plant. That is the biggest plant of its kind in the world. It's a major step that we're doing. It's a really brave step, and it carries with it considerable risks, but it won't perform. We've seen recently that one of the wind plants was hoping to get a 38% load factor. And quite honestly, the 38% load factor is achievable in about 1% of the places in the world. We might be unique, but I don't think we're that unique. So, yes, I hear what he says, that we are low, but I think that if he looks at it in the sense that there are very considerable risks that it will not perform because of its very novelty, then he will understand why I think it's a wise decision to go for as little as that. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. I think I'm not going to belabor the point, but two key thematics. Firstly, I remember calling up the portfolio committee, asking if I could attend one of the stakeholder meetings, and I was told no nuclear people are allowed. It was only renewable people who were presenting. So I think, no disrespect intended to members in the audience, there has been ongoing dialogue within the portfolio committee for more than 3 years, where nuclear, in fact, has had a disproportionate percentage of time to present its voice. So I would urge members to do, sorry, I don't want to be disrespectful, let me leave it at that. It's been ongoing for 3 years, and nuclear maybe gets the raw end of the stick when it comes to being able to put our science forward. Emotion and fact, unfortunately, if we're going to have public discourse, public dialogue, it needs to be informed. And I'd like to conclude by saying that if we can put aside our self-interest, in the pursuit of common interests for the future of this country, we may be able to have a reasonable dialogue, because as I said, I grew up on the Cape Flats in a reclaimed area with two power plants, no access to energy. So, and if you go to Richards Bay, where everybody wants to leave Richards Bay because of the complications and consequences of coal, maybe we should all move to Richards Bay and let the people who live in Richards Bay come and live on the other side of the mountain. Common interest versus self-interest. Thank you.
Yeah. I want to take another round. I'm just going to appeal once again. We have here a platform that has been created through the portfolio committee. The context in which this platform has been created is that the government is going ahead with nuclear energy. But at the risk of repeating, it doesn't mean that we cannot play our role. And part of our role as parliament is to create a platform for engagement. And I cannot pretend when I'm arranging platforms of this nature that we're not going to create a context in which the government is going ahead. I'm just freaking out because it seems that these people want to talk such that we can go back and government said to reconsider this. I'm sure if you want that to be done, there are other avenues. This could be one of them. But at this stage in time, unfortunately, the way this one was structured was not to make such considerations. With due respect, please accept that. The very fact that we started with the department was to show this is the context in which we're handling things. But obviously, one takes into account a lot of things that has been said. Maybe one should be quite upfront and reinforce what has been said. This is a journey, and it needs to be refined. And we'll take into account, because this is recorded, in fact. By the way, it's in channel 408. I even told my siblings that they must watch me. I usually post to them. M. Zanzani, yes. I don't post to other people, but Ekaya, I post. They must see Uputuabo. You know. I must give confidence right now that Honorable Khadebe, I think the point is taken. But as I say, it was four in the past. Surely, these are the kickstart. You know, out of this, we definitely sit down and reflect as to how do we remote the journey. My understanding is that there's a journey that we're taking on the nuclear space. And whether you're pro or anti, you've got to make sure that you are part of refining it. There are very, very, very strong points that are being raised. Tell us about the cost, the accuracy of the cost, which obviously I'm going to be very clear. We're not going to touch what is being handled by the NEC squared, not here, because that's in the hands of the president. Not that it's sort of scary or whatever. At the right time, they will come and be transparent about it, according to the. But it doesn't mean that we cannot create platforms to engage on this. Safety issues have been raised very, very strongly. Comparative analysis, and which I would very, very much appeal, you know, for those who maybe duck out and go pretty soon, that we've got your inputs, we've got your contacts. If we need to get more information from what you have said in terms of, responding to what the inputs have been said, we'll definitely follow up on that one. Won't back down, won't shy away. Very clearly, Mfundisi, I know I'm guilty. I did receive your offer, but sometimes things fall apart even in Parliament, no matter how much structured we'd like to be. So I know I still owe you, and I'm saying it very public. People, your inputs have been made. I'm not rushing to shut people. Anyone who'd like to have another go, please. Yeah, that's fine. No, it's fine to have debate, isn't it? It's fine, I don't mind. Isn't it, Prof? Let's have debate. Let people make inputs. This is why we're here. But the context must be understood and appreciated.
can you make a deal? Prof, okay. I want to start with the hands, the fresh hands, if I can call them. Okay, can you have the hands up? Number one. Oh, sorry, sorry, Prof. Prof, this time is the other one, the MP first. Number one, Prof. Number two, number three, number four, Professor Iken. Number five, next to Professor Mungai. Number six, right at the end. Number seven, number eight. I'm trying to be fair and balanced. I'm coming back to the repeaters. Fine. You have the chance. Okay, Prof.
Thank you, Sir. Maya Tula is a member of the committee. I'm not going to address the topic. I'm just drawing the perception now. I want to believe we need to appreciate platforms of this nature. It's not the responsibility of a committee to have stakeholders. In our meetings as parliamentarians normally, the other people don't speak at all. I think we need to appreciate the fact that this platform has been created. I'm sure if you go to other committees, they don't have such. And again, when you talk about the time, if there are 50 of us here, each one speaks for 3 minutes. If you look at the program, we're supposed to end at 8. I'm saying as we want more time to speak, it's a democracy. We can decide here from that. Each one wants to speak for 2 minutes. The reality of that is that we're going to be here until midnight. I'm just showing the context so that let's appreciate and move within the limits that we have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Gaupalele Sansweri. I'm the chairperson of the Young Midland Professional Society. I must say that I'm sad, if not depressed, probably bordering a point of psychological damage, just to say we've got the three ills of the society, which is unemployment, poverty, and inequality. My question is, how do we address the three if you do not address the question of electricity supply, which will make sure that we've got economic growth? 60% of this country is not electrified. They live in extreme poverty. Our argument here, to my point of sadness, is that we are sort of looking into our narrow interest, as to say, look into the interest of the society at large. Most of the unemployment is affecting us as youth, and I'm part of it. The PVMR closure, most of our members have lost jobs, they are unemployed, some of them have taken jobs that are actually not equivalent to our experience and degrees and qualifications and so forth. Can you please make sure that when you argue and make plans forward, we look into the interest of the society at large? Thank you.
Number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kate Davies from the Faith Communities Environment Institute, and I represent the Western Cape Religious Leaders Forum. I thank you for the previous speaker. Faith communities are really concerned about the well-being of people, and that is really our primary concern. I wanted to just table the fact that we have sent three letters from the Interreligious Council in Durban and from the Western Cape Religious Leaders Forum asking for an audience, and from SAFSI asking for an audience with the Energy Minister and with the President so that we can have a discussion around this and around energy issues. And we haven't even had an acknowledgement of any of our letters. Thank you.
Number three, who was following? Yes. No, Dr. Seven, then you had your bite. No, let's be fair, let's be balanced. Those haven't said literally anything. Yes, Professor Uken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ernst Uken from CPUT. I'd just like to cite one reference, and I think it's a very brave collection of people here today, because we would like to solve a problem. And I thought, let us have a look at what has been published, not by nuclear power, but just by a small country, Finland. Now, they are rated very highly amongst environmentalists. I think they already have 40% of green energy, as green as it can get. And they've just recently taken a decision. They've said, look, friends in Europe, we have a problem. We have lots of solar, we have lots of wind, but when neither of them give us power, we have a problem. It's a cold country. What can we do? They're too far to import coal or wood from Sweden, for that matter. So they said, we are going to go the nuclear route and we are going to build two nuclear power stations. They're right in the heart of all the greenies.
Prof, just on that point, I know you are a professor. Sorry that I'm biased because I know you. But obviously, you will share that Finland model with us. Okay, next to...
Okay, John Wormsley, physicist. 2 points. One, I was in the Witbank area very recently, and I was horrified by what coal is doing to the environment up there. We have to get out of coal. It's vital. Second point, I'd like to... We must put this business of radioactive waste to bed. The waste will be put in a highly insoluble form. It will be in highly insoluble containers. It will be packed around with stuff called bentonite clay to keep the groundwater out. If it eventually appears in groundwater and it moves very slowly through high-integrity rock that it will be put into, the radiation will have decayed in those tens of thousands of years, even 100,000 years, to negligibly low levels. This is not me talking. These analyses have been done.
Thank you, Dr. Wormsley. By the way, just before I forget, recently, I think it was on Tuesday, the department came to report to us, in a quarterly report, the Radioactive Waste Institute. Its board is just about to be approved by the minister, I think, by next month, if not November. So... That the ease of looking at radioactive waste is being institutionalized by the government. It's not left to NNR, National Nuclear Reactor, or just to the department, a separate institute. And I think we need to look into that. And looking at Mr. Odette, I would like to see the government setting up an institute without a budget on it. Because then they will be inviting our wrath. But let's give that journey or that process a chance and see how it rolls out. Right at the end, yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Daryl Hunt, independent consultant. I just want to say for the record that my speciality is actually natural gas and gas-fired power generation. And I'm definitely not against nuclear, but I think we just need to get the mix slightly better. I think gas can play a more meaningful role in the mix of dispatchable plant. And if we just take the change in capital expenditure of one nuclear power plant for one gas-fired power plant using the IRP 2010 assumptions, we can build 2,700 kilometers of gas pipeline or four LNG import terminals. And one LNG import terminal can supply 1.3 Madhubis with primary energy. So there is an opportunity next week with the Integrated Energy Plan workshops where everybody here can add their voice. It's a consultation process. The department is to be commended for that. And then obviously we look forward to see the IRP update assumption so we can have the debate and see where gas, and please not shale gas, but natural gas, of which shale is one aspect, where it can play its role. Thanks, Chair.
This side, yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important just to look at the evidence, historical evidence. Nuclear power has been operating...
Didn't introduce yourself.
Sorry, Kelvin Kim, Nuclear Africa Pty Limited. Nuclear has been operating for more than half a century, profitably and well. It's thousands of reactor years worth of operation that's in the experience bank. In South Africa, more than a quarter of a century of successful operation without environmental pollution of any sort. The evidence for safety is there. Chernobyl, there were some 60 people killed in Chernobyl. The evidence is there. Chernobyl was built without a containment vessel that was not permitted with Western reactors at the time. Fukushima, total people killed from nuclear, zero. Total injured from nuclear, zero. Yes, some people died. died because of heart attacks because they were forced to leave their houses, and they died because of the emotional shock of being moved. There was more deaths at Fukushima from the government decision to move the people out of the area wrongly than there was from any nuclear. Due to the nuclear fear that erupted after the Second World War because of the nuclear bombings, there's been an incredible level of safety and precision that's been in the nuclear business ever since. And that is
thank you, Mr. Kim.
Today, and the evidence is there.
Right at the back.
Heini Nell, independent power project developer. The objective is obviously to go for a viable and sustainable energy mix for South Africa. Now, if the government's policy decision to go for a full suite of 9.6 gigawatt of nuclear power is based on the IRP of 2010, that IRP 2010 calls for a two-yearly review. So there was supposed to be an IRP 2012, and in that IRP 2012, the whole energy mix is driven by demand. If the demand changed, then what is the platform then to change the government's policy decision on going for a full suite of 9.6 gigawatt of nuclear power? Thank you.
Thank you. So repeat us now.
I'm going to be fair. I'm going to be fair. Let's start the sites. 1, 2, 3, Baba Andrew 4, Baba Mungay 5, Mr. Lakhan is 6, and Mama 7. Yes, Mufundisi.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Our letters to the President, which have come from the religious communities, are designed to try to change the policy of government, because we are deeply concerned about this route. Our concern is for overcoming inequality and poverty, and we don't believe that centralized energy is going to do it. We want decentralized renewable energy, and we believe it's a myth being perpetuated that you can't generate a base load with renewable energy. You can now. The technology is there. It is a matter of the will being there, the political will. And our overall concern is the well-being of people on this planet. And at the moment, we are destroying this planet rapidly. Let us find ways together, let us work together, that we, with the faith communities and civil society, can find a sustainable path for the future. And so we ask for an open dialogue. We've been asking for consultation in this energy future for years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just in time, Prof. Number 2, Dr. Sarante.
I just want to respond to the questions about how I calculated the levelized cost of electricity. I did, in fact, work in the decommissioning cost in full. 15% of the plant cost, you spend it afterwards to decommission it. I did work in insurance fee to handle it if you have an accident to pay out the country. I did work in waste management fee, 3 South African cents per kilowatt hour, which the international accepted one in full. The last thing is about the demand curve. The whole issue about the demand curve is that people think that nuclear is something that you don't want. So the moment that the demand comes down, you want to kill the nuclear program. But what I want to try to show is that nuclear is the cheapest and the cleanest. So that's the one that you do want. So that's the one that when the demand comes down, that's the one that you want to keep and you want to cut down on the others. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Peter Baker again. I would just like to say I'm very gratified by your attention to the nuclear waste issue, and I'm pleased that progress is starting to be made, but a bit concerned you said there's no budget yet or something. So I'd love to hear...
No. I'm saying if the department plans to set up an institute and doesn't have a budget, they're inviting our wrath as well.
Then they're in trouble.
Yeah.
But if you don't set up this agency, you're inviting our wrath as a public, who's your responsibility
That's a deal.
To look after.
That's a deal.
So what I wanted to say is that when this agency is set up, normally it raises its funds from a levy on the kilowatt hour produced. But of course, Eskom's been running Kuberg since 1986. So will you put a retrospective levy on Kuberg? I don't think that's legal.
No.
I don't think that's legal. You can't do that.
Let's not cross the bridge before we reach it.
Well, then the issue here, Chair, because what happens next is that you would then have to only raise a levy from now on in the future, which means the levy would have to be far higher than international standards to compensate for the years that Coburg's been running without paying that levy.
Can you put that in writing and submit it?
It is complicated and impossible to commit to words in 1 minute.
But I'm making it, is that put it in writing.
Thank you very much.
Because
I appreciate
the levy is coming to best, and you know, we've just been looking at it with interest to see how is it going to play, and also the funding or financing part of it. Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Oh, Baba Andrew. Yes.
Thank you. Andrew Kenny again. I'd like to look at the real world, an example of Germany. In Germany, nuclear power was the safest, cleanest, most reliable form of electricity. And in a fit of political madness, they decided to phase it out and to spend an absolute fortune on wind and solar, both of which have proved disastrously expensive, hopelessly unpredictable, useless for baseload energy, and the result is that electricity prices in Germany are soaring, the poor people are forced into energy poverty has been, pollution is increasing, bad for the environment, bad for electricity supply, bad for the economy, disastrous for the poor. The only people that benefit from these wind turbines is a little rich elite. That's all. The rest are disaster.
The German, the German issue, please. Once again, it's like Mr. Baker, you'll give us a 2-3 page on that. So what I'm going to do now to show that this is a journey. We're not finished today. No. Baba Mungai.
Hello, Don Minge again. I'm just very glad to be here because as a radiation worker, I listen to your noises. But have you looked at the...
At the
problem is really that if you look at the U.S. Radiation Service, they looked at 10,000 of the people closest to Fukushima. Unfortunately, 3 of them got more than 20 millisieverts. Now, as a radiation worker, that means 3 of them got more than I was allowed to take every year, and in one incident year, I could take 50 millisieverts. People do not understand their millisieverts. They do not understand damage, and Barack Obama has come out now saying if there's a Fukushima in America, they will not respond in the same irresponsible way of bringing about psychological, economic, and other disastrous factors by acting against radiation, which in that case was not as dangerous by far, as was said. Thank you.
Fine, we're down this side. Yeah. Baba Lakan?
Yeah, Bonga Baba. Just for the record, I've given the Secretariat this document. We could only afford copies enough for each member of the Portfolio Committee, so I trust they will go home with that. And just to repeat where my 10% came from, it came from the World Nuclear Industry Status Report 2013. I think that's a scientific enough document. But actually, I think I want to rather listen to the members of our portfolio committee. And I think this is where the gap has been and why I think some of us got a bit upset, is that there's been lots of talk about renewable energy, and today it's the nuclear industry's time to dance, which is fair and democratic. However, I think the gap is that we have not had the chance to alert our portfolio committee on the dangers and pitfalls that are never, ever shared with them by the industry, obviously not. And, you know, on our side, we have experts who provide highly, scientific, peer-reviewed, internationally accepted, published research that shows some things that we believe our government should be aware of. And yes, Baba, you're correct when you say that the political terrain is one other. But we are concerned that the other side of the nuclear coin is not being shared. So we look forward to a session where we can share what we think the pitfalls to watch out for in nuclear are. Yabonga.
Sebonga. Mama Catherine.
I just want to say that these screens being up all the time, that's giving so much unfair time to one person's opinion. Yes, it's not fair. Think of removing that.
It's everybody's fault. We even forgot to put off the screens.
And I just want to make a strong plea that you will stop forwarding nuclear power until there is the safety things that is in place, that every person in Cape Town knows where they can get the potassium iodide, whatever they need to keep their children from accumulating radioactivity or iodine in their system, and to know which are the routes to evacuate safely, and for the existing plant. And once that's in place, then continue talking about six other plants. Because otherwise it just seems like irresponsible gambling with people, which translates to disrespect for the small person. The
okay.
parent who's got children who they don't want deformed grandchildren. That's what I want to say.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we've seen we've made an overrun.
Oh, sorry. Yes, sir.
Hi there, Chris Bellingham again. I just wanted to clarify this issue about price. And there's been some numbers that have been thrown around tonight, 2 rand 60 a kilowatt hour, claims of renewable energy prices being extremely expensive. There is no doubt, guys. There's no debate here. The price of wind with economic development commitments in South Africa is 80 cents a kilowatt hour. That's the competitive price. If you're talking about a Rand 10 plus for nuclear power, it's more expensive. Please stop all the debate. That is the fact. That is the reality.
Chris. It's fine. As I say, it's a journey, eh?
Yeah.
You've emphasized it. We just need to be creative as to how we go back and do this comparison as we move down the line. People, we are tapering towards the conclusion now. Thanks very much for coming. And look, you've given us food for thought as the committee, as how we take this forward. As Professor Mayatula has said, even if other committees are not doing this, even for our side, it's the first time we're doing this. We don't even know how Parliament is going to react to it. Remember, we take all these reports, submit them to this into the system in Parliament. And then it's up to the Speaker, you know, to see how what it does. But the assumption is that obviously anything that we do on behalf of Parliament, once it gets into the system, it goes to the relevant department. Whether it will, ours will go to energy only, but also environment and also national treasury, it's for him to decide. And Fundisi, your point is quite valid, but the thing is, allow me to defend the president a little bit. Just get into that office and just imagine how many letters come in. And I suspect the master said, oh, faith communities, they want to talk about energy, refer them to the minister. But I can totally admit my guilt because I know it's very open. I was keen for us to engage. It's just that the hands are too full. A little bit, if I can be unfair from my side, sneaking a few things. I never had anyone speaking about project management. Because one of the things that concerns me is that recently, South Africa hasn't been performing well in project management. You start something at 7 billion, the pipeline, it ended up being 24 billion. In fact, it's about to go up again, the pipeline from Etegwini to Joburg. You said, how much it meant to be 80. Where is it now? I think we need to talk about those things and be blunt and brutal about it, because the more any project goes up because of poor or shoddy project management, it bites into our pocket. And also SANHAP, I just wanted the full name. SANHAP is the South African Nuclear Human Asset and Research Program. SANHAP is not happy about the rate at which we are producing engineers, artisans, and technicians. Not only for nuclear, but just generally. I think we need to be quite honest and brutally honest about that. That we need to work with universities, not just only your Nexus and others. You know, remember, it's not only nuclear engineers; it's also mechanical engineers. Because there's a whole lot of very engineering, you know. And there's a ratio that they showed me that for every engineer, you need so many technicians, you need so many artisans. That's another just area I wanted to raise. Another area we is that sometimes I just sit and say,
as South Africans, how do we rate energy? Is it number in the top 5, is it in the top 10, or is it in the top 20 priorities of the country? Those who know, they say U.S. rates energy as top number 3. And what about us? Because also it then conditions us as to how much effort and investment do we put on energy. Not only financial investment, in all forms of means. When we make a law, that's an investment. Because it's about structuring behavior on certain things, one way or another. I'm just throwing that. And Mama Nokuti, one of the things people didn't, maybe it came up one way or another, the issue of the private sector dialogue. You see now our parliament, we've tried our bit, and there's government on the other side, you know. Well, once again, one is limited there because there's NEC squared, you know. I assume and expect they are the ones to unravel that one way or another. But now the unfortunate thing is the procurement. Everybody is eager, and obviously you'll have to appreciate government gets very jittery because there's a lot of money involved, and it has been done correctly from the very first time. Maybe we need to be creative enough to see what is it that's for public consumption, as we have done today, and what is it that we say, look, it's still kept outside. But thanks very much, everybody. But the fundamental is that all we're doing is say, here is a journey in one energy sphere, and let's see what are the various stakeholders saying in terms of refining it, and what role do we play as Parliament. This is a kickstart, as Honorable Khadebe said, you know. Let's see how we'll have to go back to the drawing board and see how we take it forward. But let's not pretend that we're not preparing for elections next year. I'm just giving that warning that that might be a little bit of a detraction or an interruption. But rest assured, Mr. Darrell at the back, surely those of us who will be taking over will look creatively in the gas sector, will look creatively in the hydrogen fuel cell down the line. We look forward into bioenergy in its totality. We look forward into handling various other, you know, energy sources and careers and technologies in these energy stakeholders meetings. Those who are here for the first time, please talk to those who have been to public hearings and compare the flavor and the character of what we are doing for now. Unfortunately, everything that we're doing is recorded, and we'll try and put together and submit something to Parliament and see what responses are there. And obviously, we will be together and take it forward. I'll admit my guilt. We started late, and I was a bit uneasy to suppress the presenters because, to me, it's not about they are proactive. It's about they are presenting information which we have responded to. Peter, this is a journey. That's why I even showed that after giving one minute input, I still allowed people to make another bite. I think I need to stop there and say, we started the journey, and give us a space and time to see how we take it forward in future, but there's no doubt our commitment to engage with various stakeholders once again has been proven today. Thank you very much. Shalom, shukran, siyabulela, inkosi, baya danki. Those who have not signed, please do sign so that we can keep in touch with you.